Welcome to the Night Cafe. This is my least favorite part where I introduce the show. My guest this week is Trevor Selby.
And you're looking at me right in the eyes, which just makes it even more awkward.
There's no good way to start a show.
Except like, you could do the intro after I leave, so you're by yourself.
Oh my god.
And then edit it in later, Marc Maron style.
My mind is blown. I never considered that as an intro.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's what's going to happen from now on. Maybe I cut the first 10 seconds of this and then go do that. All right, so this is a show I love finding out, like, what other people consider to be, like, the most influential things. And I mean, not even most. The word most seems to trip people up a lot when they're making the lists. But I ask people to come in with five things that they think had a big influence on them, and we sort of just talk about why that might be. A lot of times we get sidetracked, but
I have five things, and then I have sub things in those five things.
I love it. Let's get right into it. What's the first thing?
The very first one, because it's in no particular order, right?
Yeah, no particular order.
So, all right, well, I'll just run down the top of my list. First thing's gonna be Star Wars.
Star Wars.
If you notice, I do have the Star Wars tattoo.
Rebel.
We'll get to the other tattoo later. Yeah, Star Wars, it was not the first movie that I saw in theaters, obviously, because mm-hmm. It came out when I was, like, 10. I saw it with my dad when they did the special edition re-release in the 90s.
Uh-huh.
And my dad took me to see Return of the Jedi when I was 10. And it was not, like, my dad had taken me to see movies before, I'm sure. And apparently when I was a kid, I was always obsessed with movies. Like, my dad says that when I was a kid, I would come home from school, like, 4 years old, and I would watch Total Recall every day.
That's intense. That's
right? Or I would watch The Three Amigos every day. So, like, I've always loved movies.
Two very similar movies.
very similar genre of movies. But my dad took me to see Return of the Jedi, and I didn't know shit about Star Wars at the time. And, you know, to be there, obviously, like, I mean, we know Star Wars. Like, we know what it means to us now.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a 10-year-old. And so, just to see all of that, just totally overwhelmed me. And to this day, is the thing that I'm the most obsessed with in the world, probably. Like, and it kickstarted my conscious love of movies, and my pursuit of movies, and my understanding of movies, and my understanding of science fiction, and of the way that culture works. And like, and it was, and at the time, like, this was before Lord of the Rings came out, when everybody got into Lord of the Rings. Like, it was the only kind of, like, there was that Magic Gathering that you could, like, be obsessed with, like, as, like, kind of a nerdy person.
Yeah, or, like, Star Trek.
Yeah, Star Trek. You know, there are very few, like, universes that existed.
Yeah.
Now there's a universe for everything.
Mm-hmm.
But back then there was not. And so, like, Star Wars was definitely mine. And, like, I've read 47 expanded universe novels.
Wow.
Yeah,
you're no joke. This I'm calling it right now. You are as into this as any guest has been into any of their picks.
Oh yeah. 100%. And it's gonna be that way for all of them.
Which is why I was excited to have you on, because
the joke I always say is that I take my obsessions seriously,
because
mm-hmm. like, I'm the kind of person that, like, I'm like, oh, this looks interesting, let me learn everything there is to know about that one thing.
Uh-huh.
So that's I'm with that way about absolutely everything. I can tell you everything there is to know about soap, because I love soap, like good soap, and like butter. I love butter. And like, today I was reading about, like, you know, random, like, chancellors of Germany. Like, just, I just like to know things. And I like to be knowledgeable about things.
Yeah.
So, and Star Wars was like the first one of those things. When I had the original Xbox, I had 10 games for Xbox. 8 of them were Star Wars games.
Wow, I didn't even, that's like, that is like 8 different, so it's like Battlefront,
my favorite game of all time, Knights of the Old Republic.
Oh yeah, classic.
Knights of the Old Republic 2, the video game adaptation of Star Wars Episode 3.
That one was not good, I remember
no,
that game.
Not good at all. I was just having a conversation with a friend of mine today about, there are no, just like how there are no good movie adaptations of video games, there are no good video game adaptations of movies. At least none that stand the test of time. Except for maybe GoldenEye.
I was just going to say.
Probably the only.
There's
the
one.
Exception. Yeah, GoldenEye. And the Super Mario Brothers movie. and then whatever the fuck the rest of them were, Jedi Outcast.
Yeah, like, there's a bunch of Yeah. There's probably like a racing sort of.
Oh yeah, Pod Racer, one of the greatest racing games of all time for N64.
Yep.
One of the few games I was never actually able to beat because it's so hard.
It's because the controls are not good. Yeah, it's like a
nonsense.
Yeah. But, do you have a favorite of the movies?
Yes. It's hard because like for forever because of the nostalgia because like, it was the first one I ever saw. Return of the Jedi was my favorite for a lot of reasons. And then as I got older, as everybody does, you get really into Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
You start developing emotions, and you're like, oh, this movie has emotions. Whereas the second one, or the third one, is just like explosions and celebration. But that one has, you know, it's super dark.
Yeah.
And I do love Empire Strikes Back, but like, I kind of went back. When Force Awakens came out, I went to the marathon. It was like 21 hours total. In Sheepshead Bay at 4 in the morning, and I watched Return of the Jedi right before Force Awakens, and it could not have gotten me more jazzed to see it.
That's all. I was just going to ask, when Force Awakens got announced, were you like, yes, more Star Wars, or like tentative, like, oh no?
Always yes, more Star Wars. Always yes. And everybody is that way. There is nobody on Earth who will ever say, I would rather them put it down and never make another one, because nobody wants that. There's a great documentary called The People versus George Lucas.
I've seen it, yeah.
And the whole sum up of the end of that is like, it ultimately doesn't matter what any of us think, because if they announce a new Star Wars, we're all going to be there.
Yeah.
So
night one.
Yeah. But I will say that, like, when The Force Awakens was announced, and they were announced, like, J.J. Abrams is going to do it, it's going to be done by Disney, George Lucas is going to advise, but he's not going to be directly involved. Everybody was like, okay, this, it seems like they're doing this one right. They're going to do practical effects and all that kind of stuff, so I think they're going to do that one right. End result, I could take it or leave it, really.
Yeah, it was a fun movie.
Yeah. I was the definite, there's an Onion article that came out that was a man who's seen Star Wars 7 times thinks it's just okay. That was me. I saw it 7 times. I saw it twice the first night, and then I saw it like 4 days later, and then I saw it once a week, every week for like 2 months.
So, yeah, because it was in theaters forever, yeah.
Yeah, it was in theaters forever, and Rogue One is still in theaters, too.
Yeah.
It was in theaters forever, so, and I just bought it on DVD, like somehow I didn't own it, and I was in Target, and I was like, oh shit, I don't have this, so, and I watched it again, and again, it's like, it does so much right, but there's not enough of it that's new, and there's like, we could have a whole separate podcast just about my feelings on The Force Awakens.
Yeah.
We'll do that as a bonus
episode. I've only seen it once. The scenes that stick out in my head having seen it once are the scenes, like that, I don't even know how you describe it. There's like the monster things on the Falcon with Han and Chewie.
Yeah, the Rathars.
Yeah, I liked that. I remember that really well. And I remember thinking that Oscar Isaac was killing it.
Yeah. Because he kills it and everything.
Yo, he's amazing.
Except for that movie of A Most Violent Year. God, that movie.
Never saw it.
It was so boring. But you like boring movies.
I do.
I do not.
I have a large tolerance for just people talking and not anything else. Like,
right. Which isn't that all that Moonlight is?
No, Moonlight is a very, like, that's all Fences is. Fences is one location, 2 hours of Viola Davis and Denzel Washington yelling. It's 2 hours of that. Or, like, Clerks is my favorite movie, probably. So, like, I enjoy the...
Sure. And I do like those kinds of movies. But, my favorite subgenre of movies is where people meet in a random place and then spend the whole rest of the movie walking around that random place before midnight, before sunset, whatever the other one is, before sunrise. And then the movie that Chris Evans did with Alice Eve, where they meet in Grand Central Station and then spend all night walking around New York City. That's the greatest thing ever for me.
That's like the New York fantasy, I think. Yeah. Like, when most people move here, like, that's what they're looking to have happen.
Absolutely. Yeah. But the moral of that story is that Force Awakens is just okay. But Star Wars as a whole is the shit.
Yeah. I love that you've read so many of the extended universe.
Oh, man. I can tell. Which is a shame, because now none of it means anything.
Yeah, it's not canon anymore.
It's not canon. They're, like, slowly reintroducing facets of the canon, and they use some of the aspects of the canon in The Force Awakens, like Han and Leia. Spoiler alert, Han and Leia's son falling to the dark side, that actually happens in The Force Awakens. In the expanded universe, in a series of novels.
But he's not called Kylo Ren.
He's not called Kylo Ren. His name is Jason Solo, not Ben Solo. Ben Skywalker is Luke's son, and Jason Solo kills Skywalker's mom, wife, and then falls to the dark side and takes the name Darth Cadus, which you could vote online for that name. Like, when they announced, they're like, we have a new Sith character, we need a name, you can vote online. So I voted online. and Darth Capus is the one that ended up winning. And then he meets what I assume will be a similar fate in the end of the whatever this current trilogy is.
Yeah.
So,
you think they'll do more?
Yeah.
They'll definitely do more extended universe, but you think there'll be an episode 10?
Yeah, yeah. There'll be a second trilogy. I mean, they can keep it going forever. Like, that universe is so self-sustaining. Like, what you just have to get used to is, like, people just want the same four characters.
Uh-huh.
They want Chewie, they want 3PO, they want Luke, they want Leia, they want... But, like, the Star Wars... Like, I would love to see... not to use the word prequel trilogy, because that has a weird... That has a bad...
Yeah, so, some stigma.
I would love to see Knights of the Old Republic adapted into... series of films, or a TV series would even be great.
Yeah, I think prequels have been done wrong for so long. Like, they just did it with Harry Potter. Did you see Fantastic Beasts?
I
think the prequel for Harry Potter should have been the story of, like, Godric Gryffindor and Salazar Slytherin. Like,
yeah.
That's what they should go do. Yeah. I agree.
Not to cut you off, I'm sorry. I agree with you. I would love to see that, too. I like Fantastic Beasts only because it did a great job. It did what I think a prequel should do, and it's not really a prequel. It sets up a whole different world within the established realm of the established universe, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And they did a great job of, like this exists in Harry Potter, but it's a different place. Like, there are more than one schools, so here's another school, and I'm like, that's awesome, and I think they did a good job of that. But I do see your point in general. George Lucas's, like, career-long dream has been to do a live-action TV series that he's never been able to get it off the ground because the special effects budget would be so outrageous.
We're probably close to it, though.
We're probably close, and I'm sure it will be realized at some point, but it was going to focus, like, on the years between, like, it was going to be like an anthology series. It was going to focus on the years between Episode 3 and Episode 4 might follow, like, the remaining Jedi around, like, who will, like, have escaped capture and all kind of stuff.
I think we talked about this. A Mace Windu movie would be...
A Mace Windu movie would be fucking dumb. that's the best expanded universe novel by far. It's called Shatterpoint, Mace Windu. It's a solo story about where he goes back to his home planet, and it establishes so much that you don't know about the Force, and, like, there's, like, a whole, like, separate shamanistic aspect to it, where, like, there are people who never got picked up by the Jedi Academy who are Force sensitive and who have taught themselves how to use the Force and shit like that. It's really awesome.
What, did that come out after the movies that he was
that
in?
That came out between 2 and 3. The best of all the Expanded Universe novels, the two best series, the absolute best series is the Clone Wars novels that take place between 2 and 3, and there's God knows how many, 12 or whatever. And each one of those is really dope. Because that's the most exciting time in the Star Wars universe. And then the second best is the young Obi-Wan Kenobi stories, where he's a teenager and he's being trained by Qui-Gon Jinn. And you follow, there's like 7 of those, and you're following him and Qui-Gon on, like, their adventures. Those are two really awesome.
Those sound better. Like, those should have, like, it's funny that there's so much good stuff.
Yeah.
But, like, so when Phantom Menace came out, were you crushed? Did you...
No, I love The Phantom Menace. I am a staunch defender of the prequel trilogies. There is so much good shit in those movies. What they suffer from, which is the same thing that Indiana Jones 4 suffers from, which is there's nobody around to tell George Lucas no.
Yeah.
Like, he is unquestionably a genius, but he can get a little bit too involved in himself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the reason why the first three are great is because he only directed the first one. He didn't direct the second or the third. He was just the executive producer. Yes, he was probably the head bitch in charge, but, like, the producers and the editors still had control. But he produced these ones, he wrote them, he didn't write the dialogue for the first three, really. Like, they had people who paused that dialogue. Like, that's why the dialogue in the original three is better.
Better is an understatement, because
right.
Episode 2 has some of the worst dialogue I've ever heard in
right.
movies.
Absolutely. And then the other problem that those movies suffer from, I don't even think they suffer from a overabundance of special effects necessarily, because that was the style of the time. You can't fault them for that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of shit they wouldn't have been able to do had they not used the special effects, like all the crazy lightsaber fights. Like, the reason the original three movies just feature the guys going like this is because the physical props were so heavy they could swing them.
Yeah.
But now they were able to digitally add the light, and so they can go all crazy and do all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then But the other major problem, of course, is they're horribly miscast. The new three, particularly the Anakin Skywalker part, that was originally supposed to be James Franco.
And I heard it was DiCaprio.
I think they were both offered it, but like it was like they like.
Oh, I heard little kid like Jake Lloyd could have been DiCaprio, and then
I can see that
Franco could have been Hayden Christensen.
Yeah. Franco was supposed to be Hayden Christensen's part, the old Anakin, and he like knew like I'll be typecast as Anakin Skywalker forever. But those movies, and his career probably would have suffered, but those movies themselves would have been better. And that was before Natalie Portman was a good actress.
Ewan McGregor was a dope Obi-Wan, though.
I mean, he's the greatest of all time. He's, like, top five favorite actors ever.
Yeah, he's so good.
Yeah, and you could tell that Liam Neeson didn't give a shit.
That was a big paycheck.
Yeah, that was a big paycheck. So there's lots of, and like, if you ever watch, like, there's fan edits of the new trilogies, where they cut out, like, they cut out the Jar Jar shit, and they cut out, like, the excess dialogue. They changed the crawl to, like, get rid of the taxation. As soon as you see the word taxes, your mind tunes out by default. That's why the country's in the shape it's in. There's edits that, and they streamline everything and make them drastically better movies. But I think they serve the overall, they serve the complete story arc of that character, of Darth Vader.
I remember the first time I saw Phantom Menace, I was 8 years old, but it, like, that was the first one I saw. I saw that before New Hope, Empire, any of that stuff. And I remember thinking, like, this is cool.
Yeah. Well, that movie is for you. It was for, that's why that shit is in there. That's why Jar Jar's in there. That's why the Gungans are in there. Because that's what kids want, because that's what sells toys. If you go back to the 80s when Return of the Jedi came out, everybody hated, all the adults hated the Ewoks, but all the kids loved the Ewoks. And if you talk to kids who were around in 1999, their favorite part was Jar Jar and the Gungans, and everybody else's favorite part were the droids and the lightsabers and all that kind of stuff. So that's, I mean, Star Wars is for, people say Star Wars is for us. No, it's for everybody. That includes children.
Uh-huh.
But of course, there's like the famous, the Machete Order, where you can, if you watch them in a different order, you watch A New Hope, Empire, and then you go back and you watch Attack of the Clones, Return of the Jedi. You don't watch Phantom Menace, and then you go back and watch Return of the Jedi because it preserves the twist of I Am Your Father. And it also, there's nothing in The Phantom Menace that you need for that story because everything else is revisited in Attack of the Clones and in Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
So you can get rid of that and then just watch those five, which is what I recommend to everybody. That is the best way to watch those movies. But, you know, I like it. I was able to get through Phantom Menace.
Yeah, I know
it's... Darth Maul's the shit.
Yeah, when I remember it, the two things I remember are that last fight where it's Obi-Wan, Qui-Gon, Darth Maul. Great fight. And pod racing is awesome.
Yeah, which they never brought back, and they totally should have.
I hope that that's in the newer ones. Like, Rian Johnson maybe tosses it in as, like, a sport. Like,
that'd be awesome. I would love to see that.
Yeah, especially because now with today's effects, pod racing could be, like, the coolest thing.
Yeah. And then on that same note, talking about, like, other things, the other novel, you know, they're doing, like, these standalone stories. I would love to see what may be the second greatest Star Wars game, Shadows of the Empire, with Dash Rendar, which takes place between episode 5 and 6. I would love to see that story adapted in some fashion, because that game is awesome, and that story is awesome. There's all kinds of shit that they could do, and that's what makes Star Wars so great, is like, the universe is so vast, and it takes up such a huge amount of time, and there are so many cool-ass characters that they can do anything they want. They could do a fucking, like, Lord of the Rings-style story about the Mandalorians and Boba Fett and all that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
They just released the first cast photo for the Han Solo standalone movie today, and I was looking at that Han Solo dude, and I was like, this looks like, you know, like when they do, like, the Lifetime adaptations of, like, real life stories, like they did the Will and Kate Lifetime movie?
Mm-hmm.
That's what it looked like. Is it looked like they cast, like, a Lifetime movie version of Harrison Ford, Harrison Ford? But that's just what the picture looks like. Maybe it'll be better, I don't know. But his hair, I was like, you look like you're from that 70s show. No.
Yeah, I'm so excited for that movie, but just because of Phil Lord and Chris Miller.
Mm-hmm.
Their whole careers has been, this sounds like a terrible idea, and it turns out to be amazing.
Sure.
21 Jump Street.
It was great.
Lego Movie.
Great.
Last Man on Earth with Will Forte is...
Has its moments.
But they made a show about one guy last four seasons, so I have confidence that they can do this Han Solo thing right.
Yeah. I'm sure. I wonder if they're going to reference, like, what I want more than anything in that movie is I want the scene where Han Solo wins the Millennium Falcon from Lando Calrissian. Like, I wanted, like, a Rounders style where, like, he's playing for his life kind of thing. And pay him his money! Like, I want that. That's a bad Russian dude from Rounders impression.
Malkovich?
Malkovich.
Don't splash my pot.
That's what I want. I want that scene where he wins the Millennium Falcon from Lando Calrissian. And then that sets up the third act.
I'm sure you'll get it, too. Yeah. I'm sure that that's, like, a big part of it.
Yeah, I would love to see more of, like, that. I would love to see more of, like, with the expanded universe stuff, with these standalone movies, I'd love to see more of, like, the seedy underside of Star Wars, like the Gladiator games and, like, the Pazak tables and the gambling and, like, the underworld style. Like, when they go, like, to the lower levels of Coruscant, like that. I would love to see, like, more of, like, the crime side.
Yeah, that would be cool. Like, a super gritty crime movie in that universe.
Yeah, I would, like, you could totally, at least I could totally write, like a police procedural set in the Star Wars universe. I could knock that out of the park.
I'm surprised it's not in development already. That seems like something that would be so obvious to
me. Yeah, you hearing that, GL? Call me, boo.
George Lucas. Does he have any say? It's all Disney now, right?
Like, he has, like, advisory says, where, like, they can be like, hey, what do you think of this? What do you think of these designs? But, like, ultimately, like, it is very
But if he's like, I don't like that, and then they're like, oh, well, sorry.
That's your fault.
Yeah, it's like, we told you about it. That was all the contract said we had to do.
Yeah,
so that's interesting.
It's like when my grandmother told me that she didn't like that my brother and his girlfriend were living together, and I was like, nobody cares what you think, Grandma. Like, same thing. So, yeah. Who knows?
Yeah.
So much potential. Now they've rebooted it, and, like, they want to do one every year, and, you know, so it's in good
hands. Oh, we're getting Star Wars every year until we're both dead. I mean, that's like...
And I am okay with that.
Yeah.
I'm totally okay with
that.
And now Disney has that deal with Netflix, so, like, all new movies come out on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, all the Star Wars movies that come out are going to go right to Netflix when they come out on home video.
I love Netflix.
Yeah. The Last Jedi will hit $3 billion. I guarantee it. The title alone sells you $3 billion. That's such a better title than The Force Awakens. The Last Jedi? What, are you kidding me?
Yeah, it's going to be amazing.
Did you
like Rogue One?
Loved Rogue One. Loved Rogue One.
I enjoyed Rogue One. I loved the ending. The ending is...
It's so satisfying. Because you're like... I was talking to Bennett Hoffman, shout out, where he was talking about, like, the whole movie, you're like, they're not going to go there. They're not. And then they go there, and you're like, oh, shit, they went there!
I could have watched a whole movie of, almost like a horror movie of Vader just fucking ripping people apart.
Totally. I mean, there's whole books about that, like I said. I've read
them. Yeah, no, you definitely...
There's a book that takes place right after Star Wars Episode 3, where, like, he's in his new body, and he doesn't know how it works. And so he's, like, trying to, like, figure out, like, how to be this new Darth Vader while also hunting down other Jedi and shit.
How did that work? Were there just, like, people who loved Star Wars wrote novels and sent them and then, like,
Luke? So it started, yes and no. So it started with the brilliant sci-fi writer Timothy Zahn, who wrote the first one, which I forget what it's called now, but I read Eye of the Dark Side or some nonsense like that. But he kind of kicked off the whole thing. I mean, they are, like, all, like, officially licensed novels. But what George Lucas did was, when the first one came out, he said, anything that you guys want to add is canon. The video games were canon. The movies were canon. The novels and the TV shows, the action figures, the comic books. All of it was canon. So it all counted, which is what made it so much fun. Because then people's creative freedom was like, why don't we do anything? And then there's, like, the random, like, stuff that's non-canon, like the what-if novels. What if Lando and Leia get together and things like that?
That's just fan fiction. Like, people write, have you seen the holiday special?
I have seen the holiday special. I have the holiday special, complete with commercials and everything.
That's probably the most interesting part.
The
old commercials.
Because
I've tried to watch it
on
YouTube. No, I know. I got 15 minutes into it this current Christmas, and I was like, there's not enough weed in the world to make this ironically good.
Yeah,
like,
it is utter dog shit.
It is maybe one of the worst things I've ever seen produced.
Yeah, and I totally understand why George Lucas doesn't want people to
see it. Arthur has more screen time than any Star Wars characters.
Yeah.
It's fucking terrible.
But that novel, or that TV show, even that established the Wookiee world of Kashyyyk, which is now, like, a central element, and it established Wookiee culture, which is now an essential element of the Star Wars universe. So even that in the end, had its merits.
I love that. For a quick second, I just thought there was a novel about B. Arthur and Wookiees.
Oh my god,
which would be incredible.
I could write that fanfiction.
Golden Girls Wookiees fanfiction. It would be pretty great. Like you said, we could do a whole show on Star Wars, but yeah. I think it's well established that you love Star Wars and know more about it than...
I think that's clear.
Yeah, that's clear. I think that is a... Yeah, so what's our next thing?
Number two? Oh, gosh. Let's go... We'll go in order of, like, seriousness. So, like, we'll go, you know, we'll get more serious as we go along. Like, every good podcast, every good episode of WTF, whatever.
Yeah, I won't have you crying until, like, the fourth thing.
Right, right. Can't keep it away. Todd Glass coming out, that doesn't happen in the middle. That happens
right at the... Oh, yeah, I forgot. That was such a crazy podcast.
Yeah, yeah. And that was unintentional. So we'll go with the other tattoo then. The other number two on the list would be the band Oasis.
Nice.
So my tattoo on my arm, for those of you who can't see, is Oasis lyrics. This says, "In my mind, my dreams are real."
In another language.
In Saudi Arabic. That's my friend's handwriting. I was telling her, I know I want to get this tattoo, but you can't get English because it's douchey and it would have taken up a lot of space. And she's like, "It might look all right in Arabic," so she wrote it up. So that's her handwriting.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
That's super cool looking. It kind of... I would have guessed Arabic. My second guess would have been, like, Martian. Those are crazy letters.
I was actually thinking about Hebrew originally, but, like, this was way cooler.
You read that right to left, too? Arabic?
Yeah, Arabic's read this way to this way. And I was at... I was hanging out with a comic, Climate, who is Lebanese and speaks Arabic, and she was able to read it. And then I've had that happen. Like, I was in a record store, and there was a Palestinian guy in the record store, and he read it, translated into English, and then guess what song it was from.
That's awesome. So, that must be such a cool moment for the, like, both of you. Like, that guy's like, oh my god, I know
it. Totally. And how many horror stories do you hear about people who have, like, Chinese character tattoos, and they're like, haha, it says piss. Or shit, you know. And so, but no, this is, like, actually accurate.
So. Well, that would be so fucked up of your friend, right? Like, right? I fucking suck, like, across your arm.
So, yeah. In My Mind, My Dreams Are Real, from the Oasis song Rock and Roll Star. They are my favorite band of all time.
Yeah, they just had a documentary come out.
Yep, which... I saw it at the theater over there in the East Village with my friend.
I still have not seen it, but on my list.
It's so good. One of the better documentaries. I mean, I'm biased, of course. Like, well, yeah. I will take anything Oasis that I can get.
Well, what stopped me from seeing it, because I heard it was great, but I know very little about Oasis beyond...
Oh, see, like Star Wars, I know everything there is to know about Oasis.
That doesn't surprise me.
I have every song they've ever released, including songs that they have never released. Like, I have albums of B-sides, and I have albums of unreleased singles, and I have albums of, like, just acoustic, like, sound check jams. I've scoured YouTube. I've ripped songs off of YouTube. I've downloaded every, like, file that, like, from a torrent site that you can download. I have everything they've ever released. A lot of their best songs are shit that they've never even released. That's what makes that band so amazing, is they do not have a bad song.
That's awesome. I know that feeling about other bands. There's just something about the way that they, like, write songs. The only two I know are Wonderwall and Champagne Supernova.
Sure, as everybody else does. Which is okay, because if you're American, that is all you know. But, like, if you go abroad, like, if you go Europe, like, they are so massive. Still to this day, South America, they're like kings. Like, in America, they play, they don't even ever, I mean, they're not.
Yeah, I was gonna say, yeah, they're
like, the last tour they did, they only did 4 dates in North America. All of them were in Canada, and they were all in arenas. And then they go to Europe, and they're selling out, still, in 2009, we're selling out, Wonderwall came out in 1996. In 2009, they were selling out River Plate Stadium in Argentina, which is 85,000 people.
That's fucking crazy.
Like, they are the biggest band, like, on earth for so many people still. And they're just the greatest. Like, and I they came at me by surprise. Like, I've not... a person who's, like, always been into Oasis. I didn't get into it until I was in a sophomore in college. Never even heard them. I was a senior in high school, and my friend had, like, their most recent album, which was, Don't Believe the Truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, I was like, I've heard of this band. I was like, but I've never heard anything by them. Let me listen to this. And I heard, like, a couple of songs. I couldn't even tell you what they were. And I was like, yeah, this is all right. Not my favorite. I went back to my Three Doors Down, Away from the Sun CD. And then, like, cut to 3 years later or whatever in college, and my friend iTunes had, like, the home share, so, like, if you if your computer was connected to the internet and then my computer was connected, I could, like, play your songs, you could play my songs. And my roommate had just, like, a whole, like, amalgamation of shit, and I was, like, scrolling through his, and I saw Oasis. And I was like, I've never heard this. And I was like, I heard Wonderwall, and I heard Champagne Supernova, and he had What's the Story, Morning Glory, the song.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, what's this song? And he played it. And then as soon as it do-do-do-do, and I was like, whoa. Like, and then that chorus comes in, you know, and then, what's the story? And I was like, the hair stood up in the back, and I was like, this is going to be a thing.
Have you ever seen Scott Pilgrim versus the World?
Of course.
Yeah. I always describe the opening scene when Knives is watching them play. That's the best depiction I've ever seen of someone hearing something for the first time and being like, oh, this is my shit.
Yes.
Like her on the couch as they're like getting farther away and like all the, like, I know that feeling. Like,
yes, absolutely. And like, and it's the best feeling. Like when something just overwhelms you and you're like, this is going to be,
yeah, this is my shit forever now.
This, like, this is my shit forever. And then immediately, you know, torrenting was like, not new, but like still like primitive.
It was like LimeWire.
LimeWire and like shitty dorm wired internet connection. Cause I'm 100 and I went to school in the mid 2000s and our dorm internet with our Xbox Ones. Or with, like, our original Xbox.
Yeah, like,
the original Xbox system link, so we could all play Halo 2 with each other. And there's, like, a file, like, the Oasis discography, and I downloaded everything, and it took, like, 6 weeks. The connection was so shitty. So, and it's, I mean, I've listened to, like, if you go through, like, do you have, like, the track, you know, you have the track counter on iTunes?
Oh, yeah.
Or my case, Google Music, if you go through, and it's just, like, you know, it's like 60 times, 40 times. You go through Oasis and it's like 700 times. Like every song is just like looped through over and over and over. I'll just like put the whole thing on. Like if I'm having a bad day, Oasis is where I go. I mean, I'm like, this will put me in a good mood fast.
Yeah.
And they're, I mean, Noel Gallagher, he's the best songwriter of the last 25 years, without question.
Yeah.
And of this, you know, from a pop music perspective, like nobody writes a better hook. I mean, even his solo stuff is still brilliant.
I was just going to ask, are the solo stuff...
Love it.
It's, what's it, Flying Circus?
Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds.
Flying Circus is Monty Python, right?
Yeah, Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Yeah, that stuff's good, too.
It's so good. And, like, and he has this ability to both write lyrics that sound great that mean nothing... That are just like he's like, these words just sound good together.
Every Nirvana song.
Yeah, and it makes a great chorus. And he's like, but then he has other songs where they just like, they punch you right in the face, you know, like with your feelings.
Yeah.
And like the song Slide Away, which is my favorite song of all time. Like, from the first note, I'm like, yeah, it's like heroin. I'm like, yes. And then that chorus, and the story of that song is so emotional and so like, it's so, like, it's sad, but not sad. It's like Nirvana. Like, it's high energy, but, you know, or Cheap Trick. Like, it's high energy, but, like, kind of dark and sad. Like,
yeah.
It's a sad song, but it's so anthemic, and it's done, it's so satisfying. Like, we were talking about the ending of Rogue One. It's such a satisfying song to hear. I mean, all of his music is.
Mm-hmm.
It's, oh,
yeah, that's awesome. Have you ever seen him perform?
I have never seen Oasis or Noel Gallagher.
Well, they're not. They hate each other. Noel and Liam, right?
Like, well, they don't hate each other now. Like they did when they first broke up, like every band's do. But now they're just like, yeah, they're like, yeah, you know, like we're Noel Gallagher says we're fine because we don't talk to each other.
Yeah,
they text, like they see each other at their mom's house for Christmas, things like that. But like they're not, but they're fine enough. Like Liam wants to get back together. But Noel, he's like, why? I don't need it. He's like, I've had 2 number one records on my own. I tour the world and sell out arenas on my own.
Yeah.
Like, he has all of the things that Oasis had without all of the shit from Oasis.
They'd have to, like, back up a truck of money to his house.
Yeah, basically. And he even said that. Like, there was a rumor a while ago that they were going to be paid $500 million to do Glastonbury.
Holy shit.
And then Noel Gallagher, he was like, I'll do it for $500 million. Anything. Packs of cigarettes, condoms, crackers. I don't care what it is.
That's an insane amount of money. That right? is... Oh my god, that makes fucking Ed Sullivan's Beatles offer look right. like nothing.
ABBA were once offered $1 billion to reunite, but they even then they turned that down too. But yeah, he's like
probably because they thought it was fake. Yeah. Like, there's no fucking way anyone's giving us $1 billion. Right. ABBA.
Yeah, and there's nobody, and there's no fans who think that ABBA's worth $1 billion.
Nobody.
Sure.
Nobody in the world except whoever this one person.
Right. Some billionaire who's like, I fucking love me some ABBA.
And it was probably one of those like Saudi princes that
Saudi
like has like Mariah
or, like,
Carey
or some Swedish billionaire, like some guy like the owner of Saab or something like that.
It's one guy who's seen Mamma Mia like 1,000 times. Like,
right. Meryl Streep didn't do it justice.
I want the real thing. And they'd probably be so disappointed. Imagine you paid $1 billion and they just weren't that good.
Right. Like, yeah, they're average at best. They just stand there. Like, it's not like they dance. They're not like A-Team or like NSYNC. Like, I said A-Team. That's random. But like,
they did dance a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And they did a lot of ABBA covers. So like, it's. Yeah.
Everyone remembers Mr. T's version of Dancing Queen.
Yeah, they do. Oh, God. Yeah, man. Oh God, Oasis. They're just so good. And Noel is hilarious, like as a person, like as a human being. He's like I don't think aside from maybe Jerry Seinfeld, I don't think anybody has ever handled fame better than Noel Gallagher. Like, he loves being famous.
Mm-hmm.
He loves what he gets to do because of it. But at the same time, like, doesn't take himself seriously. Doesn't take his life seriously.
He was a great Nerdist podcast guest.
He was a great Nerdist podcast. I just wish had been longer. But he's the man.
I remember he had one of my favorite things I've ever heard someone say, where he's like, people will come at me like, why don't you write songs like you did in, like, the late 90s? He's like, you think I fucking would if I could? Like, you think I'm on purpose? Like,
right, yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I love, like, he's really honest about his own assessment, like, of Oasis, where he's like, we put out 2 great records, 2 good records, and 4 okay records, which is 50%, which is better than most bands get. That's so awesome. My favorite phrase I've ever heard about Oasis was from a music reviewer or somebody, and they said, Oasis is what happens when you have 2 brothers, only one of them has talent, and both of them know it.
Oh, poor Liam.
I know, right? But it's so true.
That's gotta suck.
It's so true. He's got a great clothing line. Oh, he's talented in other ways.
Yeah, I'm sure he's doing fine. Yeah. But it would be kind of like if, like, Tegan was like, fuck you, Sarah. I'm gonna put out, like...
Right, I'm going solo. Just Sarah. Tegan Quinn. Sarah Quinn.
It's not outside of the...
I mean, that BDI record was just awful. But you know what I love about Oasis, too, is, like, we have this obsession of... like the original lineups of bands, you know, like people always want the original lineup. They want the original Guns N' Roses lineup. The original Guns N' Roses lineup is not the best. The second lineup is the best, the one with Matt Sorum on drums and not Steven Adler. Oasis is the exact opposite. Their last lineup was the best lineup. And if they get back together, that's the lineup that I want to see, because they have so much more power, so much more musical chops in that last incarnation of that band.
Cool.
And their drummer is just like a monster on that last. And then their middle one, they had Ringo's son. But their last drummer was better.
If there was, for people like me who don't know their extended discography, what's the one
definitely
record?
Definitely Maybe. Their first one. Definitely Maybe.
I like that. I thought you were going to say, like, definitely this one.
No,
but
definitely
it was
Maybe.
Definitely Maybe.
Yeah, definitely Maybe. And then I would actually say, like, What's the Story of Morning Glory? That has all the songs you know. That has Wonderwall. That has Champagne Supernova. That has Morning Glory.
Uh-huh.
That has Don't Look Back in Anger, which is the best song on that album. But yeah, definitely Maybe. That is like the purest essence of that band. And then I would actually say I would listen to one of like their more obscure records. Not obscure because they were all number ones, but like Heathen Chemistry is a great album. Standing on the Shoulder of Giants is a phenomenal record that does not get enough credit because it came at like a weird time in music, but that's a phenomenal record. And then their one after Morning Glory that always gets shit on, Be Here Now, is really... That's like that album is the sound of cocaine. But there's some good-ass music on that record.
Yeah. Well, so. Cocaine's been responsible for tons of great art.
Yeah,
so.
Absolutely.
The whole 80s, basically.
Yeah, David Bowie, his album Station to Station, he says he does not remember making that album. Like, he's like, I don't know what this is or where it came from. So.
It seems like a lot of that era. I always say that, like... Paul Verhoeven movies, like RoboCop, like those are 100% coke.
RoboCop
movies.
Was my shit when I was a kid too. That's another one. That's like another classic staple of my childhood is RoboCop.
So. Final thoughts on Oasis?
They're the greatest band of all time, and everybody should go and listen to them. Particularly the song "Slide Away," and then there's a particular version of the song "Slide Away" that I recommend everybody watch. It's on YouTube. Oasis have the best live shit on YouTube. There's a whole concert that they did in Argentina at the River Plate Stadium, 85,000 people, and that crowd is so rabid, like you can't even hear them playing it sometimes. And when he does "Don't Look Back in Anger," Noel at the end of the career for Oasis, that would be his solo spot. He would do "Don't Look Back in Anger" acoustic by himself. And there's one particular version where he doesn't even sing it because the crowd is singing so loud that, like, and there's one point, like, there's a, like, right before the very last words of the song, there's, like, a pause, and then you see him stand back, and there's, like, tears in his eyes, because he's, like, this is, like, so overwhelming. Their live footage on YouTube is unreal. There's a version particularly of the song "Slide Away" from a 2008 tour rehearsal that they did, where they, like, it was, like, broadcast on MTV. They're, like, in a tiny-ass club, and there's, like, 20 people watching them, and they rip into "Slide Away," and it's so heavy. And the best part about that song, if you've never heard that song, is, you know, Liam sings the whole lyrics. The whole song is about, as Noel describes it, it's about two people who realize that they're soulmates and also realize that they can't ever be together.
Yeah.
And doesn't that just, like, you feel that?
Everybody has that one person, too. Like, as soon as you say that, like, everyone, that one person pops in their head.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. It happened for me. I'm sure it's happened for you. And so, and Liam sings the whole song. And in the studio version, in the background, over the last verse, in the background, you can hear Noel singing very lightly. And he's singing, "I don't know, I don't care. All I know is you can take me there. I don't know, I don't care. All I know is you can take me there." He sings it over and over and over and over and over. And then the very last part, he just goes just over and over, "Take me there, take me there." And he just says it. And in this live version, when it gets to that last chorus, Liam stops singing, and Noel does it, and you can hear it. But then, right when he gets done with the last "Take Me There," he turns around, and he just rips, like, the most epic, like, outro to that song you've ever heard. That song does not have an outro. It just ends with that last "Take Me There" on the studio version. But he does this whole super long outro that's like, and Noel doesn't play solos. So mm-hmm. It's just like all like just him crazy, like doing fingers and fretting, and like shows him how awesome of a guitar player he really is. And like it just adds to the whole emotional intensity of that song. Like the original solo in that song that takes place in the middle is already awesome because it's supposed to simulate like the emotional breakdown of like when you realize you can never be together, and it's like beep, and then it comes in. But then that last one just like, oh, I have it, like I ripped it off YouTube, and I have it. It's terrible quality, and I haven't ripped it, but I listen to it all the fucking time.
That's so great.
Tour rehearsal version of "Slide Away," Oasis Live on YouTube.
If there's one takeaway from this little part. Okay, cool. We're gonna take like a quick break right now, and then we'll get back into number three. Okay, cool. So what's our number three thing?
Okay, well, let me ask you this. At what point are we going to talk? Should we talk about comedy? Should we save it for the end? Should we do it now? Because that, I think...
That's going to be a big one.
Is it going to be a big one? Okay, so we'll save comedy for the end. We'll get more serious, and then we'll end. We'll send the kids home happy, and we'll close with the comedy.
Up to you, man.
So number three, then... would be the second most important like event to happen to me in my life was my, I guess really it's a person, it was my college girlfriend that I had. So my senior, with the end, we started dating the end of my junior year and then dated all the way through the end of my senior year. That was super important because it was my first real relationship.
Uh-huh.
And it was my first like more adult relationship. Like it was more than just like, oh, are you my boyfriend? Okay. Like we lived together.
Yeah.
Like we planned like events together, and like we met. She's the only girl who's one of the only girls who's ever met my family. And super, super important. Tommy like kind of helped me mature in a lot of ways. Like before I met her, before we started dating, I was like every other college kid. Like I was obsessed with video games, and I was obsessed with pizza rolls. I still am obsessed with pizza rolls.
What's not to love?
Right, what's not to love? It's a perfect food. It's pizza in bite form. I can't have pizza rolls because I'm losing weight. I gotta wait like 6 weeks. I won a free pizza today from T-Mobile for Papa John's, and I almost wept because I can't have it. I can't have it. Anyway. And so she told me, and then like when I met her, like she was like, hey, there are other things that we can do for fun. We don't have to just play video games. And I'm like, really? There's other things? Like, I shit you not. This is not a joke. I went to my college for 4 years. My college is a college town. It exists for my college.
Where'd you go?
Bowling Green State University in Ohio. Northwest Ohio, just south of Cleveland, or just south of Toledo, rather, about an hour south of Canada. And for the first 3 years, I never even like set foot off campus except because I don't drink and I didn't drink in college. So I was like, well, why would I go?
Yeah, I was
like,
at the bar.
The only thing to go there is to go to a bar, and like, I'm not gonna go to a bar because I'm not gonna drink. I'll just stay here, watch a movie, eat pizza, and play video games. So, aside from the one bar in our town that showed all the WWE pay per views, so we would go for those.
Yeah,
other than that. And they had mini corn dogs. So, like, I would go for that on Sundays.
Sounds like a dope place.
It was great. Thus far. So, I never knew reason to go. Cut to her. Like, she had friends who were, like, townies. Like, they were from Bowling Green. And she was like, hey, let's go out and about. And I'm like, where? And then she's like, well, we can go to the park. And I'm like, there's a park? And she's like, we can go, you know, to the city pool. We can go to the reservoir. I'm like, there's a reservoir. Let's go throw shit in it. So, like, you know, shit like that. Like we ventured beyond campus. Like, I remember when I crossed, it's literally Main Street. When I crossed Main Street and, like, went to, like, I was like, I've literally never been on this side of, I was like, this is the farthest I've ever, it's like the scene in Lord of the Rings when Samwise is like, this is the farthest I've ever been from the Shire. Like, it was the same thing. I was like, this is the farthest I've ever been off campus. This is crazy. So, like, you know, got to do all kinds of fun new things. And then, and that just kind of stuck with me. Like, after we ended up breaking up, but ever since then, that was 2010, I rarely ever played video games. Very rarely. Because, like, they're just not interesting. Like, there are so many other things now that interest me more, that occupied more of my time. So, you know, it's so like, and then that breakup itself is what really was super instrumental in making me the person that I am today, because like that was the most devastating thing I've ever gone through, like, as everybody's first major real breakup is. And it's super important. It needs to happen.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody should get dumped. Is the moral.
Really makes you reevaluate everything you've done, said.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You get a new perspective on yourself.
You do. You totally do. And I was like, I was so devastated. And it took me forever to get over it. Like, years to, like, fully get over it. Like, I mean, there was probably, like, a 5-year period where I don't think a day went by that I didn't think about her, you know? And it did not end well. And we still are not on good terms, although that's more my fault. And I remember, like, when we broke up, I blamed her for everything. I was like, this is entirely your fault. There's a great song by the Black Crowes called Good Friday that my friend Isaac and I, we got dumped at the same time. He's like my best friend from high school. We got dumped at the exact same time. And this song was like our solace. And then the chorus of the song is about two people who break up and they have to meet up one final time to like exchange things and do the whole thing. And the whole chorus of the song is, I will not forgive you, nor will I accept the blame. And that's how I felt for years. I was like, I will not forgive you. I will not accept the blame. And then one day, like 5 years later, so this is 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I'm sitting around. I don't remember what I was doing. And for whatever reason, I had seen something or whatever, and she came up in my memory, and, like, I just had, like, a flash of, like, that entire relationship, and then the way that it ended, and I realized in that instant, it was entirely my fault. Every single thing was my fault. And in that moment, like, that realization, like, this huge, it sounds so corny and cheesy to say, because this isn't a relationship podcast, but, like, this is for Love and Spit with Jacob Futhi, free plug. And like, this huge weight came off my shoulders.
I'm sure.
And I was like, oh my God, I totally get it. And in that moment, like, I was a fundamentally different person. And I realize now that I've looked back and I've analyzed more, in college, like, I was so insufferable. I was so controlling of not just my girlfriend, but, like, everybody in my life. Because, like, I, as every person in college thinks they are, they think they know how the world works. And, like, I know how the world works. I know everything. I know the way this world should be. And I wanted everybody in my life to conform to the way that I viewed them and the way that I think that they should act in the world. And so I was super controlling. I was super judgmental.
Uh-huh.
Like, I did not drink at all. And, like, I was, like, I was a hardcore straight-edge person. No drinks, no drugs. I still have never taken drugs of any kind. And if my friends started drinking, I was like, you're not my friend anymore. I don't want anything to do with you. Like, you're being a piece of shit. This is ridiculous. How could you do this? And then, like, you know, with my girlfriend, like, she was younger than me. She was a sophomore when I was a senior. And I would see her be confronted with the same choices that I had to make. And I was so sure that I had made the right choice. And so I would tell her, I was like, don't do that. Like, I've been here. I know how this is going to go for you. And then she'd be like, let me make my own decisions. And then she would make the wrong decision. And it would end up exactly the way that I would tell her. And one time she told me, why are you always right? And I was like, well, I was wrong for a really long time. Turns out I was still wrong. Because what I learned is that there are lessons in life that can't be taught, that can only be learned. So, like, you have to let people fuck up. And so my mistakes that I'd made that ultimately led her to break up with me was that, like, I did not want her to drink. You know, I was like, she had friends, so, like, they wanted to go out and party. And I was like, no, can't hang out with those people because they're going to make you drink. And if you're going to be with me, you can't drink. Which was a super fucked up thing to do. But I didn't realize that at the time, because I was an asshole.
Yep.
And my mom will tell you. My mom's a big fan of telling me how big of an asshole I was.
We have that in common.
Yeah, yeah. It's
my mom listens. Hi, Mom.
Hey, this is Pastor Eddie. You know, you're right. And that really is, and Mom, if you hear this, like, that one of the hardest parts about getting older is realizing that your parents are right about everything.
Almost everything.
Almost everything. And that's shitty, because you're like, you don't know me, you don't know what life is like. Turns out your parents have been dumped, and your parents have gone through shit, your parents have been fired, they've lost their jobs, they've gotten bad grades, had bad relationships with their parents, like... Your parents go through shit. Like, when you get older, you realize your parents are also just people trying to figure shit out, too. You know, and I'm the oldest of six, so, like, my mom didn't know what she was doing.
Yeah.
I say this on stage, like, my mom's favorite phrase is children should be like pancakes. You should be able to throw the first one away. You know, so, like, that breakup, like, devastated me. But then, like, once I got through it and I survived, that's when you're like, oh, like, if I can get through that, I can get through anything.
Uh-huh.
And then you're good. You know, forever, you're good. Mm-hmm. You're like, I've been through that relationship. And, like, I just recently went through a breakup, which was not fun and was very sad. But as I was going through it, I was like, I know that I'm going to be okay.
Yeah.
And, like, I'm beyond the point, and this is not a dig, this is not a slight, when I say anything like this, it's not about any of my previous girlfriends, like, I'm beyond the point of, like, being in a relationship where I'm like, you're everything to me, you're my whole reason for living, and then when you break up, you're like, you ruined my life!
Yeah.
That'll never happen.
No.
So, like...
Yeah, that's a youth thing, like, that's like a...
It's totally a youth
thing. And everybody gets one, like you said, you need one, you need to do it.
And the younger that it happens to you, the better.
Yeah.
Because then you can get, like, there's people, like, now who are in their late 20s, that I know, who are, like, in their late 20s, early 30s, who still haven't gone through it. And I'm like, you're going to be so fucked.
My last year of college, it was the worst.
Yeah, it was
and bad. We didn't, and it, this wasn't even a girl that we had, like, we had been good friends for a while and then started kind of doing that. And then she was like, I don't want to. It was like a year long process of, like, on and off that was fucking terrible. And I can still make myself sad thinking about it. But
I can still make myself sad. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's something that's always with you. Like, holes don't really heal. Like, when somebody blasts a hole in your life, it stays open.
Yeah.
Which is a lie I learned from the show Burn Notice. But it's 100% true.
No, it really is true. Like, it'll always sort of be there. And I agree totally that, like, with time, you look back and you're like, oh, that's why this happened.
Yeah.
It's because I was being a dick.
Yeah. And once you're able to self-analyze like that and you realize, oh, the behavior that I'm currently doing is not acceptable behavior, it makes you such a better person. And, like, I am such a different person now than I was in college, and in a good way.
Uh-huh.
You know? And I loved college, and I still have friends who I talk to every single day from college. Mm-hmm. And hilariously enough, all of my friends who are like in like our circle, me and my girlfriend, when we were in that circle, they've all said that unquestionably she came out of it worse. Like she's a worse person.
Really?
As a result, because she did. She's well, maybe not now, but like at the time, she had, because she had never been broken up with. She'd only ever broken up with people. And then I guess her senior year of college, the guy that she thought she was going to marry dumped her, and I was like, ha ha. Now you know.
It's vindicating.
And so now she's probably a very fine person. And I sometimes wish that her and I could know each other now as adults.
Yeah.
And know that we're such different people. But them's the breaks.
Yeah. No, it's so true. It's what happened. I always... there was this point my senior year where, like, all four people that lived in my house were in some sort of stupid romantic struggle. Mm-hmm. And that was the thing that got me through it. Because I would look at one of them being all crying and stupid on the couch. I was like, whoa, he looks so dumb right now. And I know I look just like that. Yeah. And I want to suck it up because I don't want to look like that. Nothing against them, but it was like watching someone else go through a breakup makes you kind of take a step back. Like, oh, is that what I look like and sound like to people? Like
my friend Isaac and I were like that. We were sitting around just the saddest people watching what's the movie with Quentin Tarantino? Why am I blanking on the name? Not his first movie, but his second movie.
Pulp Fiction.
Jesus Christ. I kept wanting to say Vincent Vega. And I'm like, no, that's the character of Pulp Fiction. That's not Pulp Fiction. You know, we're just sitting around on his couch, sad, watching Pulp Fiction. And we're like, this can't be what life is like. But when you see other people going through that same thing, that's what makes you realize, like, oh, I'm not alone in this. Because everybody, when you're young, every experience has to be unique to you because you've never experienced it. And you're like, no one has ever gone through what I've gone through before. When in fact, literally everybody on the planet Earth has gone through exactly what you've gone through. And when you start, and so when you have those realizations, you're like, oh shit, like I'm a normal person. Like, and I'm alive and I'm a feeling person. And it makes you a better person for it.
And everybody's an asshole sometimes.
Yeah,
and yet, like, it's about reconciling it and recognizing it and doing it less. It's not something you can get rid of.
And that's why, like, the people that I pity the most in the world are people who peak in high school. Because, like, that popular guy in your school, like the captain of the football team or whatever, with very few exceptions, usually doesn't come out of life on the end better off. Like, usually they're, like, they're the person. Like, I remember a couple years ago, I was back in my hometown in Ohio, and I was taking my sister's dog for a walk to the dog park, and I saw a guy one of the guys from my class was at the dog park. We started chit-chatting. And I was like, hey, Ben, man. He's like, oh, man, you know, life fucking sucks. He's like, you know, just working at, like, a factory or whatever the fuck he was doing in Ohio, some meaningless dead-end existence that it is. And he was like, I tell you, man, life's just gotten so much worse since high school. And I was like, really, dude? Because my life is fucking rad. I don't know what you're talking about. So that's what makes life so interesting. And like, and it's those malcontents in high school, like the ones who struggle, the ones who aren't that popular, the ones who are nerdy. Those are the ones who come out of it on top in the end.
Yeah.
And it's awesome. So, like,
have you ever seen the episode of South Park where Kyle talks with the ghost of Abraham Lincoln?
No.
All the girls in the class make a list of the boys, ranking them on cuteness, and he ends up at the bottom. And he has this whole crisis, and he has this dream where the ghost of Abraham Lincoln takes him to the ugliest kids in his school. And he's like, look, that kid's practicing the piano. Like, when he's older, he's going to be a fantastic musician. And then he takes him to the number one, and he's just looking at himself in a mirror. Like, it's the...
I have a friend in high school who, like, he never had a girlfriend in high school, and, like, he's super into the guitar. Like, he plays ass off.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, one is a girlfriend. And I was in college at the time, and I was like, trust me. It was my friend Isaac. I'll just say his name. Fuck it. the guy who I was watching Pulp Fiction with. He's my best friend. We were in a band together in high school. He's been playing guitar since he was 14. He's a master. But he was like, oh, one is a girlfriend. And I was like, Isaac, trust me. When you get to college, people appreciate things like talent.
Yeah, or personality.
Personality and genuineness. And then sure as shit, he gets to college within 3 months. Had a girlfriend, and now he's getting a master's degree in jazz guitar performance and composition.
It's fucking dope.
Yeah, so
it's fucking awesome.
Yeah, and he's got, you know, a wonderful girlfriend and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So
I that was my experience with leaving college, because I was not my college was very much like a high school. Like, there was not a lot of people there. It was 5,000 kids total.
Okay.
Very preppy. Very much still.
That's a shame.
Yeah, it was terrible. Like, the only thing that got me through it was we had, like, this little improv group. So there's 8 people out of 5,000 that I'm like, yeah, you guys are awesome. Mm-hmm. And then coming here, that was that.
Yeah.
Like,
that's interesting because, like, was it a private school?
Yes.
Okay. I've never been to a private school, obviously. I think they're probably good for grad schools, private schools. But I feel like one of the essential functions that public school serves is social development.
Mm-hmm.
High school is that way. That's why it's important to go to a public high school, because, like, you get to experience people from all walks of life. If you go to a private school, most usually people are the same. I don't know what it's like in college. But, like, I went to a state school with 30,000 people, and it shows you, like, oh, you're both unique, but you're also not the shit like you think you are. And it, you know, and, like, when you're in high school, you realize, like, oh, the friends that I only had because, like, it's a small talent pool, and, like, we're forming friendships on the loosest of interests.
Like, your neighborhood is the same, like...
Yeah, your neighborhood are like, you like Smash Brothers? I love Smash Brothers. Let's hang out.
Of the people I still talk to from high school, of the, like, 6-7 of them, 4 of them were just, like, on my bus.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. That was...
And there's nothing wrong with that, because, like, I'm still great friends with those guys. But, like, when you get into college, you're like, oh, I can find people who, like, tailor to, like, my specific interests and, like, the people that I want to be around. But that's interesting that you're talking about that transition, because that also is a super key aspect of life, is the transition from college into real life, that graduation. And, like, and I'm sure you probably experienced this. Everybody I know has gone through this, which is, like, you graduate from college, and then it's followed by, like, 6 months of depression. Because you're like, I don't know what to do. I've never not been in school. Like, especially when August rolls around, and you're supposed to go back to school, and you don't want to go back to school, and you're like, oh, shit, what do I do? And then you're like, I want to go back to school, because that's all I know. And then once you get through that, then you're like, okay, I'm good. Like, but that graduation into transition is so important, because it, like, a mental break happens in your mind where you're like, this part of my life is over, a new part is beginning, I must now move on. And how many people do you know from if you go back to your hometown, who went to college for 4 years or whatever it was, and then didn't graduate, mm-hmm. and then still are living life like it's college, like in their late 20s,
uh-huh.
early 30s? It's because those people don't go through that break.
Yeah.
And that's how you end up the guy who peaked in high school.
It's funny. My experience was very... It was, like, similar but the opposite. I was miserable my last year of college. I wanted out so badly. Doing these comedy shows was the only thing keeping me from, like, killing myself, basically.
That's
okay. So the second I graduated,
You were relieved?
Yeah. No, it was the weight of the world was gone. I was like, fuck everyone that goes to Marist. I'm so done. And then I graduated May 25th, June 1st, stand-up.
Nice.
And then since then, this has been the happiest point of my life.
Nice. And that's awesome. That's awesome that is the case. And you still came out of it okay.
Yeah, no, I'm not like...
Yeah.
This is the ideal me to know. There was a lot of shittier versions.
Sure, yeah, just like me. There's the 22-year-old me was an insufferable dick. And the 25-year-old me was an insufferable dick.
Yeah, I'm sure I'll look back at all and feel the same way. I feel like, yeah. Like that's just growing up, probably.
That's just growing up. And what I, like, growing up sucks. Being grown up fucking rules. I love being, like, you get to do stand-up comedy. You live in New York City, you get to do stand-up.
It's the coolest thing.
Whatever you want. The next subject that we're going to talk about is one of those things where I was like, I can do whatever I want. I'm going to do this thing.
It's the coolest thing.
It's the coolest thing.
I'll remind myself of that sometimes. If I'm ever, like, in a bad mood or something, I'm just like, you can walk into comedy clubs and people are like, hi, Anthony, which is, if you told your 18-year-old self that, he'd, like,
yeah.
shit his pants, like,
yeah.
So, like,
100%.
Yeah, I agree. It's a...
But everything up to that is an essential part of that. Dating a girl, getting broken up with, having a miserable year and graduating, or graduating and having a miserable following year, which was my case.
Yep.
You know, so it's, all of that is essential to becoming that kind of person. And it's interesting, I guess we'll talk about it more once comedy comes around, but, like, I started comedy when I was 18, but in Ohio, like, you gotta drive an hour to do 5 minutes, like, it's not worth it.
Yeah.
So I didn't really start doing stand-up until I was 26, and I feel like I'm a better comedian out of the gate, because I was older, because I know who I am. Like, the first 10 years of comedy is just you trying to figure out who you are. And then once you know who you are, your comedy's better. I already know who I am, so I think that my comedy, this might be arrogant, is better than a lot of people who started, who are younger, who are at the same point in their comedy career.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get more into that.
Yeah. On that note, I always feel like I have a pretty good sense of who I am because I was a depressed kid and like an alone kid. Like, I spent a lot of time just like alone, just thinking about stuff. I'm a
classic comedian.
Well, kind of. I just am naturally a loner. Like, some people have a hard time being by themselves.
I'm the total opposite.
I love my alone time. Have you, like, going to the movies by myself is like, that's my church.
Yeah. I mean, you and I talk about this. I love going to the movies by myself. When I was younger, I loved going to the movies, like, in a group.
Me too.
Getting 12, 15 people together, but now I love going to the movies. I did the Star Wars marathon by myself.
That was the big split in high school, was I didn't start drinking until I was 21.
That's good.
Yeah, like, and I was, there was a moment we were 17 and all my friends started smoking weed, and I was still the guy that was like,
yeah,
let's use that $20 to go see a movie.
Right, and that's a good thing probably for your ultimate later development, and maybe for their later development too.
Yeah, I mean, so there was a split, and then my junior year of college, everything kind of went off the rails, but
and that's okay. That's what college is for. I never had a single sip of alcohol until I was 23, and I can probably count on two hands the number of times I've consumed alcohol since then. I've been drunk one time.
I love aspects of it, but I totally get why people are like, this isn't.
Yeah, see, I don't, like, at all. Like, I was like, because in my mind, like, it doesn't make sense from a logical perspective. It's like, people would, like, I'd go to parties and people would be like, you're not drinking? That's so weird. And I'm like, well, no, in fact, the weird thing is the fact that you feel you need to put a chemical in your body that alters your state of consciousness just so that you can have a 20-minute conversation.
Yeah, that's when you put it like that, no, it is super true. It's like, that is messed up.
I was like, because I'm so obnoxious as a person already, and I'm so social a person already, and I'm so energetic and hyper, that, like, I don't need to drink to have a good time because I'm already going to have a great time.
Well, that's amazing. That's an amazing quality
and
to have.
And then the commitment to it doesn't seem worth it. Like, okay, I'll drink, and then I'll have slightly more fun for 4 hours, and then spend the entire rest of the next day regretting it. Or I can have a really fun time already tonight, and then tomorrow wake up and have more fun.
Yeah, and you never wake up with a text that's just like, you called my friend a fucking skank, like, right to her face. Like, that's never happened to me. That was a fucking example.
Yeah, but that's happened to anyone.
Yeah, no, there's tons of people.
I'm larger than really, I'm sure, listening to this podcast.
I always love going on Snapchat and seeing a story that's just somebody that says, it's like their face, and it's like, I'm so sorry for last night. Yeah. Like, everything I said.
Do you remember the website Texts from Last Night?
Oh, yeah.
When I was in college, like, that came out, and that was everybody's life. And, like, I was reading it, and I'm like, these are funny, but, like, I don't relate to, like, this has never happened to me. This has never happened to me. This has never happened to me.
The only time I ever got myself in trouble because I was drinking, it was so dumb, and it's so my personality, too. I had found a video on the internet. I was drunk. And it was disgusting. It was, like, truly, it was someone trying to smoke a cigarette with their own prolapsed butthole. And then as they, like, pull in, it, like, goes back in and sucks the cigarette in. And you could see them, like, ah, because it, like, burns them. And I took a Snapchat video and sent it to everybody in my contacts. And I woke up the next morning with messages that were, like, that was not okay to like, show me.
That's
pretty
great.
Yeah, that was, so I'm glad that was the worst it got.
Yeah, that's really fucking funny. Yeah, I mean, I remember, like, when the one time I got drunk playing the game Kings, drinking Tom Collins, and
Kings,
and I was sick for 2 days afterwards. I was like, why would anybody?
Well, yeah, because getting drunk fucking sucks. Like, when you can't, like, move and you're puking, like, that's no good.
It's just logically has never made sense to me. But, you know, teach their own. But if I was the younger me, I would have been like, our friendship is over. Like, you know, now I'm like,
well, yeah, it doesn't seem like a big enough thing to.
I'm like, yeah, do what you want. I remember my friend was telling me about, like, she's like, yeah, I spent the weekend doing a lot of cocaine. And I was like, yeah, and she was one of my friends from college. And I was like, yeah, if we were in college, that'd be the end of our friendship.
It's funny because you're a big movies guy. So, like, in movies, were they like, that are totally about drugs were you ever just like...
Hate them.
Well, you were just saying you watch in Pulp Fiction. I mean, there's heroin in...
Yeah, I did not like Pulp Fiction.
Oh.
I do not... I mean, ironically, like, that's probably my least favorite Quentin Tarantino movie.
Death Race.
Oh.
Or Death Proof or whatever
Death
it is.
Death Proof? I like Death Proof. yeah, I, you know, it's not my thing. Like, I hated Pineapple Express.
That came out,
I
like...
I hate Seth Rogen's entire career. I cannot stand that dude. Like, I'm sure... Like, obviously he's funnier than me, because, like, he has a career, so, like, what do I know?
He's got a pretty great career, too. But, like, he's, like, 31.
I hate his stupid stoner laugh. I hate his stoner laugh. I hate his fucking stoner movies. I hate all of it. I cannot stand any of that. I don't get Cheech and Chong.
Well, I don't get that either, but I feel like... Like, there's a... Comedy doesn't age fantastically most of the time.
Correct.
So I think that was always what I attributed my not understanding Cheech and Chong for. Because definitely, like, I smoke marijuana a decent amount. My mom's laughing her ass off right now. Because she knows it's way more than a decent amount. But, yeah, I was wondering about that when you mentioned Pulp Fiction before.
No, it's just not, you know. I mean, I watched it obviously because, like, I'd never seen it, and, like, I'm not gonna not see a movie that I don't know anything about. But, like, you know, it's okay. Like, I obviously quote it like everybody else and stuff like that. But it's just, it was not my thing. Yeah, like the whole stoner comedy thing, like the drug comedy thing. The Hangover, okay. I thought the second one was better.
Really?
Yeah, because the second one makes more sense to me because, like, the first movie. It's just them going around, hey, what happened? Hey, what happened? The second one is them doing the same thing, but they're not able to get answers. So, like, the premise, to me, makes more sense in that movie.
Todd Phillips is an interesting guy. The second one is so much darker and, like, more fucked up than the first one, too. And I think that a lot of the ideas from the second one might have been in the first one, and they were like, hey, maybe fucking calm down for a second. And then when it was a hit, he was like, well, I'm putting what I want. Because he used to make documentaries. He made one of the best documentaries I've ever seen. It's on YouTube. It's called Hated. It's the story of G.G. Allen and the murder junkies.
Yeah.
Todd Phillips, at his senior project at NYU, was the documentary about him, like, right before he died. It's so good. And it's fucking gross. So,
and now he does Hangover movies and all those random, like, R-rated average comedies.
Old school,
The Road Trip.
Due Date,
that's the one I was trying to think of. So,
well, yeah. So, that was actually, I love that pick. Nobody's done a relationship yet. And,
oh, cool.
And what is more influential on somebody than that? Like, that's what more than half of movies and songs are about anyway.
Totally. That's why I totally relate to Oasis.
Yeah.
Number four, then?
Yeah, unless you have anything else to...
I mean, I could go on.
Final thoughts, if you have anything.
I'm good. I think it's funny that you're following up your podcast with Steve Malloy with me, like, somebody who, like, the only thing he cares about is drugs, and the last thing in the world that I give a shit about is drugs.
It's super funny, right? Like,
I love Steve Malloy. Steve, you're the shit.
That's sort of what I was shooting for, though. Is like,
yeah, you want different
I have a lot of interesting friends.
Yeah, you do have a lot of interesting friends, and I appreciate you having me on. And with that, this one is similar to a previous guest, Mr. Robert Sheehan, is Living Abroad.
Living Abroad would be
my number four. The single most, like him, the single best thing I've ever done in my life, the single most influential thing I've ever done in my life, I spent a year living in China, teaching English at a university. Without question, the best thing.
Was it like a full, like, lecture hall of Chinese kids?
Most of whom had never seen a white person, but who spoke flawless English.
Wow.
Because they have to learn it from the time they're five through college. They don't have a choice. And so, like, it's just, you know, because it's the language of business.
Did they speak very properly?
Yeah, they speak really properly. And their handwriting was phenomenal, better than my handwriting. Like, I would leave them notes and they'd be like, we can't read. And but it's funny because, like, they have a different understanding of language than, like, we do, in the sense that, like, they would come to me and they'd be like they'd show me a sentence and they'd be like, where would the past participle go? And I'm like, I don't fucking know, dude. Like, do you know where the past participle is in your fucking characters that you do? And they're like, no. And I'm like, yeah, exactly. Why would I know? I'm a native speaker. I don't know this shit.
Yeah. It's
like, I know nouns, verbs, pronouns, adverbs, adjectives.
Your job was to probably get them to more conversational.
Yeah, so
right?
My job, like, actually, I taught English listening, so my job was to get them to orally comprehend somebody speaking English at them in a conversational sense. So, like obviously, if I say, "Hello, my name is Trevor. I am your teacher." Like, if I speak slowly, they can understand that. If they listen to this podcast, wouldn't understand a fucking word. You know?
Yeah.
So, like, my job... So, by the end of the year, like, I was able to talk to them like I'm talking to them... Like, I'm talking to you right now at a regular conversational pace, and they were able to more or less pick up what I was saying. And I got all kinds of reviews, because, like, I'm an awesome teacher. Because I studied... Like, that's what I was going to do before I majored in politics, was be a teacher. So, I'm really good at it. And I got all kinds of, like, they do reviews of their teachers just like we had to do, and, like, all the reviews were like, he wasn't the best teacher, but he was the most fun teacher. I learned the most in his class, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because, like, we had to read, like, I had the easiest schedule in the world. I taught two classes on Monday, two classes on Tuesday in the morning, like, 10 a.m. through 1, Monday, Tuesday, and then the whole rest of the week off.
That's fucking crazy.
Yeah, so, like, I spent the whole rest of the week traveling.
Which city were you in?
I was in a city called Dongying in the whatever that fucking province is. And it's about 6 hours outside Beijing. It's northeast China.
Was it, like, a big city?
It's a small city of 2 million people, which in China is small. China has 100 cities that have a million or more people in them.
That's crazy.
And that's only a tenth of their population. Not even a tenth of their population. Yeah.
Wow.
It's wild.
Yeah, that's insane.
And the whole city is built around the oil. It's like their version of Houston. Like, it's all, it only exists for the oil industry. That's all that's there is shale oil. And the school I taught at was an engineering school. It's all people who are going there to major in chemical engineering or some kind of industrial engineering so that they can go and work for the oil companies. But you need to know English if you're going to work in that business, because obviously, like,
your top buyer is
America, yeah, or some other country, and English is the language of business. So, and I would do, like, random classes every once in a while, or, like, I would teach little kids English, or I would teach, like, adults who worked for the oil companies English, like, remedial English classes, things like that. So, but it was a small town of 2 million people. Like, 5 years before that, they didn't even have cars. And then there's, like, 60,000 cars or whatever it was. It was crazy. It's crazy how fast they build shit in China.
Wow.
But it was very, like, kind of a backwater town. Not a lot happening. To get out, like, to go somewhere else, you had to take a 3-hour bus to the capital city of the province and then catch the bullet train or the air or a regular plane to wherever else it is that you wanted to go. So, like, it was, you know, it was a pain in the ass to get in and out. But it was a nice town. It was quiet. I did not like it at first because I was like, I'm so isolated. Like, I'm not going to be able to see anything that I wanted to be able to see. But, of course, you know, like everything else, like, you settle in and you realize, like, oh, this next place is all right. And it's got its own charms in itself. And you grew to really, really love it and loved being there. And I still got, you know, and then I got my awesome schedule. I was like, oh, I can travel all the fucking time. It's no big deal. I was like, I spend one day traveling there, one day traveling back, and get 3 days in whatever city I wanted to be in. And I had friends all over China that, like, when I first got there, I had to go to Beijing for a week. And then I took this class that, like, taught you, like, welcome to China. Here's what you need to know. And, like, it was, like, 30 people in that class. And became friends with a whole bunch of them. So, and they were scattered all throughout the country. So, like, I would go and visit all those guys. Two of them are, like, two of my best friends who I still talk to. One of them I talk to every single day. The other one I talk to, like, every once in a while. He came, like, back to America with me and hung out with my family for 3 weeks. He was from England, you know, shit like that. So,
cool.
Yeah.
Do you speak at all Chinese?
EDM, which means a little bit. Not really. When I was there, I could. I learned enough that I could travel on my own, you know, like taking trains and buses and ordering food and all that kind of stuff. And there, but it's been 5 years or whatever it's been. So, like, there's some phrases that I remember. And some, you know, so, like, if I went back, I'm sure I could pick it up again.
Yeah, pretty quick.
Yeah, I remember, you know, like, you know, how much is that? Or, like, I want that, you know, things like that. Because that's how you learn to get by. It's like, when you go to a restaurant, you obviously can't read the menu. So, what you do is you walk around people's tables and you're like, oh, that looks good. Wo yao jiga, I'll have that. Wo yao jiga. Or, you know, like, duo xiao qian is like, how much is that? You know, things like that. So,
that's super interesting.
Yeah, I can count to, you know, 10 or whatever it is.
So, what made you pick China?
So I didn't pick China. What actually happened, I wanted to go to Spain, and the program that I went through I didn't get my passport in time to apply for Spain. I missed the deadline.
Uh-huh.
And the next deadline coming up was China. And I was like, fuck it. Why not? I was like, I hate my job. I gotta get out of here.
What were you doing?
I was working for a car dealership in Ohio. It was like my first real job outside of college. And my job was to take pictures of the cars and post them on the website and Auto Trader and all that kind of stuff to drive in-store traffic.
Yeah.
Great job. Great people. Still friends with the people that I worked with. And it was run by a husband and wife. And the wife, her name is Lisa. Lisa Severi, shout out, changed my life. She's the one who told me, like, I was randomly just like, I didn't know that teaching abroad was a thing. I didn't know you could do that. And I was like, I was thinking about, like, what would I really like to do? I was like, I'd really love to, like, live in another country, move abroad. You know, so I was like Googling, like, moving abroad, how to move abroad. And then I came across, teach in China. And I was like, what the fuck is this? You can teach in China? And I told her about it. I was like, Lisa, is this what it is? And she was like, no, I didn't. She was like, you should totally apply. You would be great. And I was like, okay. And then I didn't end up doing that one. I ended up doing, I went through a different program that had Spain. I was like, ooh, let's go to Spain. But then I ended up going back to China anyway. And it was the best thing ever. I'm so happy that I went to China. And I saw so much. And I still, like, I would love to go back. I had an opportunity to do a second year, move to Shanghai down south, and get paid, like, twice what I was making. But then I got a job offer in New York. And I was like, well, you know.
Yeah, New York City.
New York City.
It's hard to
pass
it up.
The other life goal is New York City. I was telling my brother. My brother, because he just texted me, because he is thinking about teaching abroad.
Uh-huh.
And he wants to do Asia, because he studied abroad in Korea, and he loved it. He's like, I'd love to go teach abroad. What did you think of China? I was like, I fucking love China. And he was like, why didn't you ever do it again? I was like, well, there were other things I wanted to do. I wanted to move to New York, and I wanted to do stand-up. And he was, you know, so that's what I did. But I could go back, like, right now. Like, if I lost my job today, I could make a phone call, have a job offer in China, and I could be back in China in April teaching at a university if I wanted to.
Wow.
So that's the great thing about it, is, like, once you make those connections, because school's always happening. There's new semester.
Yeah, always kids.
And if you have experience, they'll pay you even more. So, like, one of my friends, like, still lives there. She's been doing it now 5-6 years. Mm-hmm. And she makes probably close to $60,000-$70,000 a year in a country where you live for pennies. And, you know, lives in a high-rise in Shanghai. And it just has an awesome, rad life teaching English to students.
That's... What's like... What was your day-to... Like, going out, like, or meeting people? Like, what would you go do?
Well, it's funny because... After a while, no matter where you are in the world, after a while, it becomes like any other place. Like, you find your routine, you settle into your routine.
Uh-huh.
And so, like, you know, you think that it's more glamorous than it is. Like, oh, like, I'm an adventurer, and, like, I'm out. But really, like, most days I was spent watching episodes of Top Gear on my laptop, because that's all there is to fucking do.
Yeah.
I bought the James Bond box set and watched all the movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would do one a night. Like, I would buy food from street vendors outside, and then I would watch a Bond movie, and that would be my life. And then, you know, every once in a while you would travel. But the way you meet people is, like, especially as an expat, there are organizations that exist to help expats connect with one another.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you just fall into those communities. And, like, there's all kinds of expat pubs that you just go to, and, like, there's, and you're like, oh, shit, you know, there's a whole community in Dongying of, like, probably 200 of them. Dongying, like I said, 2 million people, and there's probably 200 expats in this town, and they would get together, like, for weekly dinners and things like that, and we would, you know, travel together and hang out, and, like, so you just learn, you know, there's Facebook groups for, if you can get a VPN, that'll get you on Facebook, there's Facebook groups for all that kind of stuff. So you just make connections that way. And, like, and this is going to sound braggadocious, but, like, it's easy for me to make friends. That's never been an issue for me.
Uh-huh.
So, like, I can have a conversation with anybody, and I can make friends with anybody. But honestly, a lot of the friends that I made that I hung out with were my fellow teachers. Like, I was not the only teacher at my school. I was one of four.
Uh-huh.
So, like, we became, like, a family. And, like, we're still somewhat close. We still talk and all that kind of stuff. You know, and then through those people, like, you meet other people. And, like I said, I had my friends from my class in Beijing that I would go and visit, and they know people, and you just spread out like that. And I've made a lot of friends with a lot of my students. Like, they love nothing more than hanging out with the white people, the Uyghurs, and or the Meghwas, which is Americans. So, like, you just, like, if I wanted to go to the grocery store, like, I call one of my students and be like, you want to go, you know, go to the mall? You know, because you, I, like, if you go to the mall, like, you don't know where shit is. So, you're like, I need a guide. So, you call one of my students and be like, hey, you want to go to the mall with me and buy you dinner? And they're like, yeah. And then they run over and, you know, we do that whole thing. So, yeah, I mean, it's like any other place. You meet people by going out to bars and clubs and you know, wandering down the street and stuff like that.
That's just
the way it goes.
Awesome. Was there any difference in, like, being, like, like, you mentioned the VPN thing, like...
Oh, yeah. So, like, are there differences, like...
Like, what are the biggest, like, wow, this is... What was the biggest culture shock moment?
The biggest culture shock moment, I think, for me, was the realization that Chinese people, for no fault of their own, have no concept of personal space.
Huh.
Because there is no personal space. Because China, geographically, is the same size as America. But imagine America with literally four times as many people.
Yeah.
How bad would this city be?
This is fucking people? Impossible.
Yeah.
It's shitty now.
It's fucking impossible. The whole country is like that. You spend your entire life shoulder to shoulder with other people. There's no concept of personal space. So, and there's no concept of, like, shame, really. Like, I mean, there is, like, there the concept of face is really big in China, which is, like, your social reputation, your social standing. And there are things that you can do that affect that social standing, but not things that you and I would think about. Like, if you're walking down the street and you gotta pee, you just walk to the side of a building, you whip out your dick, and you take a piss, and then you just keep on walking. Or, like, I've seen kids taking shits in gutters. Like, that's just how China is.
Yeah.
You know? Especially outside a major city, like Beijing and Shanghai, they're a little bit different. So, like, that's a huge culture shock. And then the way I best describe China is, like, as it compares to America, like, in America, basically, like, you go through life, and every once in a while you get socked in the face. Your girlfriend breaks up with you, you lose your job, you lose your apartment, something like that, relative dies, something like that. China, that doesn't happen, but you spend your whole life with somebody just going like this.
Just
tapping you on the arm, just little bit. Like, not, it doesn't hurt. But it's just constant, and it's always there. And then one day, you're riding a bus, and a fucking old lady is sitting next to you, and then she sees you, and then she spits at your feet because you're a filthy American. And that's when you're like, I don't need this shit! Like, that's the moment. That's what China's like.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's
but it's great. Like, it's... They're wonderful people. Like, Chinese people, like, they're so generous and kind, for the most part. I mean, like, every civilization has their assholes. You know, we apparently have 60 million of them who voted for our president. So, like, you know, every country's got idiots. Every country has racists. Every country has ignorant people. But of the 1.3 billion Chinese people, probably 1 billion of them are wonderful people who are so kind and so helpful and fucking love America.
Yeah, well, the
more
NBA
than America
is...
America loves America.
Like, the NBA is, like, one of the
They're
biggest
gods.
Things. Yeah,
they're gods. All my students, like, they take English names, and all the guys took their names from, you know, basketball players.
They were all, like, LeBron and...
Yeah, like, LeBron. Like, one of my students' names was LeBron Parker for Stephon Parker and LeBron James. Like,
that's fucking
And, like,
so
I remember they had, like, a oldies tour. Like, all these legends came through, like, on an exhibition tour and played basketball. And that shit sold out like that. It's crazy how much... And they love American movies. And they love American TV shows. They love American music. Still, like, I mean, Taylor Swift and Justin Bieber are as huge there as they are in America. Jason Mraz did a tour of China, and, like, every single show was, like, mobbed. You know, it was crazy. The funny part was, like, my school, every school in China makes you do physical fitness. So, like, every morning you gotta, like, not us, but, like, the students had to get up at 6 a.m. and then go exercise, run, do gym class, you know? And they play music over the loudspeakers throughout campus to, like, wake people up and, like, get you motivated. And one of the speakers was right outside my window, and they would play American pop music every morning. So every morning at 6 a.m. without fail, I would hear, hey, hey, you, yeah, I don't like your girlfriend. Hey, you, yeah, think you need a new one. That's all you hear. So, like, it's, in some ways, like, it's like being in America. It's like, oh, this isn't any different. You know what I mean? And they love, like, singing competition shows. That's the only thing that's on TV in China ever, are singing reality shows. So, you know, and, like, the phrase I would hear all the time is, like, people would see me, and they'd be like, where are you from? And I would say, Meghwa, which is American. And they'd be like, America, number one! Like, they love America. And that's the biggest misconception I think people have is, like, the red menace of China. Like, China, they're coming for us. They own all our debt. They're going to own this country. Thank God for Trump. He's going to stand up for them. Could not be farther from the truth. One, they don't own all our debt. They own the largest minority share of our debt. But that's a separate political question that I can get into on my own podcast that I'll eventually have one day. But they just want, they have the perception of, like, if you want something, find somebody who has that thing and model what they do. Chinese people want a good job. They want good schools for their kids. They want a house. And they want social, and they want to know that their families are going to be taken care of. Who has that? America. So that's, they just want what we have. They want houses. They want futures for their children. They want good jobs. They want secure homes. They want to feel safe. That's all that anybody wants.
Yeah, that's like the human want.
Yeah, they're not any different than us. They just, and they model themselves after us because they see how well we do it. The advantage that they have is they don't have to worry about democracy. So they have capitalism without democracy. So it's like supercharged capitalism over there. It's wild.
Really? Wait, so it's not like full communist?
It's communist only, kind of in name only. So, like, because there's no government system on earth can watch 1.3 billion people, can control 1.3 billion people. So the laws don't really apply. They kind of warp reality. Like, people have, they're more or less by default as free in China as we are in America, only because people can just get away with shit because nobody's watching. Like, there's so many people within the Communist Party. So the Communist Party that rules China has 30 million official members. Every one of those members gets a vote on leadership. So, like, there is democracy within the Communist Party itself, but it's a one-party state, and not everybody is a member of that party. But they're fine with it for the most part, because the number, if you know anything about politics, you ever study, like I said, I have a degree in politics, the number one rule of dictatorships is, as long as you're making people's lives better, they'll let you stay. The minute that incomes drop, or wages drop, or jobs stop, that's when change comes. So, like, right now, like, China just keeps getting better and better and better and better. Literally 20 years ago, Shanghai was a village. And now it is the global metropolis that is quadruple the size of New York City. You know? So they're fine with it. The only thing that annoys them is, if you talk to them, like I would talk to students, I would talk to adults, the only thing that annoys them is the internet censorship, only because they're like, why are you wasting so much manpower controlling something that we all get around anyway? We all have VPNs, we all have Facebook, we all have YouTube, we all have pirated movies and DVDs. Like, why are you wasting so much money and manpower on it? You could be focusing it on other things.
Kind of sounds like our war on drugs.
Yeah, it's exactly what it is. It's just like the war on drugs, but it's the war on thought. They're like, why? Like, we all...
Yeah, it's like,
you make us all go to college where we learn from American professors. Like... You know.
Yeah, stopping anybody from getting something that they're just going to do anyway. Like, at a certain point, it's like...
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that was, like, one of the biggest things that China affected me about. One, it was like, you know, I'd never done anything like that, and I wanted to prove to myself I could do it. Like, I did not come back to America. A lot of my friends went back, like, at Christmas break. I didn't do that because I wanted to prove, like, I could live on my own. Immerse myself. And I wanted to prove that I could, you know, survive in another society. And... But it also, like, made me a better person, made me a kinder person, and made me a more thoughtful and aware person. You know, the famous phrase, I forget who said it, you know, travel is fatal to prejudice. 100% true. You know, I thought all the same things about China. Like, my mom was really afraid when I would go, because I have a tendency to run my mouth and say things that I shouldn't say. And she's like, you're gonna get thrown in jail for the shit that you say. And, you know, that obviously was not the case, but, like... It does make you more thoughtful. It makes you more aware. It makes you more conducive to, you know, other things. But it also, like, it both radically altered my political views, and not radically altered, but also, like, drastically reinforced, like, how important it is. And it reinforced my views in the sense of, like, I've seen a country that does not have a social welfare system. that does not have a healthcare system of any kind, let alone like a universal one. Mm-hmm. Like, I've seen what happens when a society lets people fall through the cracks. Like in China, if you are crippled, you're left for dead.
Yeah, you're fucked.
Unless you have family who can take care of you, which they can't because they're probably as poor as you are, you're fucked. Like, I've seen a man with no legs pushing himself around on a skateboard, begging for money to survive. And, like, I've, like, there are hospitals, but, like, they, you know, they charge you an crazy amount of money. I've also seen, strangely enough, it gave me a real appreciation for the IRS. Because, like, in China, and this is the same problem that Italy has, which is why Italy's in the shape that it's in. China and Italy, they don't have an organization that collects taxes. They just hope that you pay. So, like, China has a private college system just like we do. Like, you have to pay money to go. Everybody takes out 60 grand in loans and goes to college, and then nobody repays them because there's nobody watching. Like, there's no credit monitoring bureau that's going to affect your credit score. There's nobody who's going to take your money out of your bank account. There's nobody who's going to call you and harass you, shit like that. That doesn't happen. So, like, people just don't pay. They don't pay taxes. They don't pay their debts. They don't pay their bills. They don't do anything like that, except their cell phone bills. But, like, that's just the way it works. And that's why Italy's in the shape that it's in, because for 80 years, no one in Italy has paid taxes. And now they're surprised that they don't have any fucking money. So, like, when I hear, like, Rand Paul, that asshole, talk about we need to abolish the IRS, no. The IRS is the best, or, like, literally the most efficient government organization, the most efficient tax collection agency on Earth. And it is why we are still number one. Like, it plays a huge part in it. And so, like, just the education that I got when I was there just made me, you know. So, like the point is, like, America, in more ways than we would like to admit, are similar to China in that we have people in this country who are starving. We have people in this country who don't have health care. You, probably me, probably you.
I'm on my dad's still.
Okay, because until you're 26, and then you get kicked off. Which they're going to repeal Obamacare anyway, and then you're going to get fucked. I don't have health insurance. And, like, we have 5 million children in this country who go to bed hungry every single night. We do not have an adequate healthcare system we do not have an adequate social safety net that cares for the elderly or cares for the infirm or cares for those who are not able to care for themselves. All of the same things that China has. So, like, that's why, like, I was, like, so much more... that I came back from China so much more progressively liberal in that sense of, like, no... we need to take care of these people. People say, oh, Bernie Sanders is going to make us just like China, or Barack Obama is going to make us just like China, or Hillary Clinton is going to sell us out to China. No, Donald Trump is going to make us just like China. When they take away social safety nets, when they take away education, when they take away access to food for children, we become like the communist states that we claim to fear. And we have nothing to fear from China. They just want to be like us. That's all they want. And that's something that we should be encouraging.
That's super interesting.
It's super... I could go on. No. It's immensely fascinating.
No, that's so cool.
Yeah. And it really, like... And it really highlights, again, like... I guarantee you... the vast majority of people who vote Republican in this country or who voted for Trump in this country have never been outside the United States.
Oh, for sure. They've never been to Canada. Yeah, they're the middle of the country people... Yeah.
The middle of the country, or they're the people who are affected by the illegal immigration in the South and the Southwest and things like that. But I guarantee you, if you spent a week in China or a week in India or a week in, you know, if you spent a week in China or a week in India and then came to America and saw the similarities and then went to Europe and saw the communist, socialist democracies that they have over there, and you saw how much that shit doesn't happen, Bernie Sanders would win in a landslide. I mean, you see all those polls all the time of, like, if the rest of the world could vote, like, Barack Obama would win with, like, 95% of Hillary Clinton. Because it's all of the things that all of these other countries have that we don't have. We're more in tune with Russia and China and Venezuela, whose society is collapsing around them. And Greece, which is now the third most poor country. Greece, the country that invented democracy, is the third poorest country in Europe. And, like, the fifth most poorest in, like, the Western Hemisphere. Some crazy shit like that. Like, when you see all that, when you see all that stuff, you realize, no, the IRS rocks. And universal healthcare is the shit. Free public education is the key to maintaining a dominant American society. Like, it's, you know, it's
sad that 3 months ago that would have, you know,
exactly.
It's too late now. Like,
exactly. And we're never too late. Like, I do think ultimately the things will be okay, but that comes from my sense of relentless optimism.
Yeah. Well, things usually do work out. That's the right attitude to take right up until they don't.
Usually work out. The only thing that I do have trepidation for is the environmental stuff.
Oh, we're fucked.
Like,
we're dead.
Every scientist agrees that if we don't, by 2020, if we don't start cutting our greenhouse gases, and by 2030, we have not cut our greenhouse gases, the Earth will turn into Venus, and we will all...
We're done.
We're done.
Our grandkids are fucked.
Yeah.
That's it.
The only thing that gives me hope for that is knowing that technology improves at such a rate now that at some point in the future, we will come up with technology that can geoengineer the Earth and we can literally reverse it.
Which
could happen.
I hope so.
Which could happen.
But, I hope so, but that shit is terrifying.
Yeah, that's just terrifying. Also, going back to China, one of the other things that I noticed about the difference in education is, like, we hear all the time, and it gave me an appreciation for American education in the sense that, like, we always hear all the time, Chinese students are the number one in the world in math and science.
Yeah.
And that is true. I can ask a Chinese student how to spit out, you know, what's 974 divided by 1,287. They can tell you what that number is in an instant without thinking. They can recite formulas and equations and they can do all this stuff. What they can't do is think critically. Because in China, they do not teach critical thinking skills. They don't unlock artistic talent. They don't seek out. Like, in America, our schools, for the most part, are designed more or less to find what is it that this person is good at. Let's nurture that skill. That's why we produce more culture than any other society in the world.
Uh-huh.
When I taught English listening, what I would do is I would have them write a story, and then they'd have to read the story out loud, and then the other students would have to tell me what the story was about based on what they heard. And when I told them to do that, the next day they came back with stuff they'd printed out on the internet, like stories that they just found on the internet, not stories that they wrote themselves, which is what the assignment was.
Uh-huh.
And then they just thought that I wouldn't notice, but of course I noticed because, like, they all have titles, like The Raven. And I'm like, fuck it, I know what that is.
Yeah.
So, like, because they couldn't do it. They couldn't come up with a story on their own. It was not until I took away their phones, took away their internet access, and forced them to do it that they were able to break out of that mold and able to come up with stories on their own. It's not ingrained in them. Whereas America, yes, we're not as good as math and science, and we could be better at math and science, but we are so much more creative and we're able to think so much more critically, at least most people in this country. I mean, you know, the education disparity also varies widely.
Yeah, but for the most part, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
That was an awesome pick.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll get into your number one in a second.
Cool, because I also... And we're back.
Yeah, we're back. All right, and the biggest, I always say they're not ordered, and then right as number one comes up, I'm always like, it's time for the big finale.
Right.
But, like...
Right. So, I tried to be, like, specific in my choices, because, like, you were talking about, like, we joked on the phone, where I was like, my choices are going to be comedy, food, you know, movies, music, things like that. So I was trying to be, like, really specific and boil it down. This one, obviously, is going to be comedy.
Yeah.
But I tried to, like, narrow it down as much as I could, and I got it down to, like, there are four kind of key moments in comedy for me, four key things in comedy that kind of influenced me and shaped who I was.
Perfect.
So the four are, you have to start it, every time you say it, you have to start it with Bill Cosby himself, Robin Williams live on Broadway.
Okay.
Lewis Black's The End of the Universe, and Late Night with Conan O'Brien.
Cool.
Those are, like, the four most influential comedy things in my life.
Mm.
I wanted to be a comedian my whole life, since I was 8 years old, when I saw Bill Cosby himself on VHS at my grandparents' house. And I've seen that special still to this day, probably, with the exception of maybe Robin Williams live on Broadway, more times than I've seen any special. And I can recite it to you. Mm-hmm. And I auditioned for my high school talent show doing a bit from Bill Cosby himself, a bit about him going to the dentist. So Like, that is, I mean, we know the backstory, but, like, the man on stage is a master, and he's the greatest storyteller to ever live.
Oh, yeah. Separating art from people is, like, a big thing now.
Yeah, right? I think in some cases it's justified, and in other cases it's not justified. Like, I don't have to separate Roman Polanski from his work. Like, that dude is a piece of shit. He should be a pariah. He should be banned from Hollywood. We should not watch his movies. I do not respect people who do his movies. You talked about the movie Carnage the other day.
But I was just going to say, what's the major difference there?
The difference is that, like, he actually did that crime.
But Cosby actually did the crime, too.
Yes, but...
He did it, like, a lot of times, too.
He did it a lot of times, but I would argue that, like, his impact... Well, there's two differences.
Well, like, Rosemary's Baby is a filmmaking classic.
Yes,
like,
but there's two things on that. One is, Bill Cosby's influence on the genre of stand-up comedy is unlike any other person... with the exception of maybe, like, Lenny Bruce, like, that has ever lived. Roman Polanski is a great filmmaker, and he's made some classic movies, but he is not, like, I wouldn't put him as, like, a titan of filmmaking. The second difference is, he committed that crime 40 years ago, and has continued to work, and people have continued to work with him. As if
as if it didn't happen. That is a big...
Bill Cosby's career is over.
Well,
it literally was not until 2013 that people knew anything about it.
Well, people have always known. It's been like a Hollywood legend. Like there's that episode. There's an episode of 30 Rock that came out in like 2008 where Baldwin hands Tracy Morgan the phone. He's like, Bill Cosby wants to talk to you. And he kicks it up. He's like, how dare you try to speak to me after what you did to my Aunt Linda in Cleveland? And so it was like a known thing.
I didn't know that. That's funny. So I guess that's the difference in a way, is like, we didn't know about Cosby. The public didn't know.
Yeah, it was like a Hollywood secret.
Yeah, until the end. Like, his career had more or less been over for 35 years at that point, you know.
Well, his career...
Not career, but like...
Well, he was only... When did the Cosby Show end? Like...
In the early 90s, I think.
And then from there...
Didn't really do much except public speaking and all that kind of stuff. And then he had that special that came out like in 2013 that was great. It is a great special. And it was right after that fucking Hannibal Buress opened his mouth. And
well, you're saying it like he didn't rape a bunch of people.
No, I know. That came out. I just dislike Hannibal Buress so intensely.
Really?
Would not be famous if it was not for that.
Oh, Hannibal would totally be. He was in TV Stoat. Like, he was in Eric Andre. He was on Broad City. He was an up and coming.
It's a personal thing. I don't get it. But I don't get it. There's a lot of comedians people love that. I don't get it. But anyway, we'll get into that. So I guess that's part of the difference. Is like I could like.
Well, people didn't have to work with him. Like, he was a solo artist.
Yes.
Like, filmmaking such a collaborative process.
But I guarantee you that if that had happened, like if that had been revealed in the 80s, there never would have been a Cosby Show. There never would have been any of that stuff. Like, his career would have been over in 1985 if they had admitted it in 1985, or whatever year it happens to be.
Uh-huh.
But Roman Polanski was convicted of that crime in 1973, and for 45 years has continued to make movies that Oscar winners have continued to participate in. And side note, you mentioned the movie
Carnage.
Carnage. I showed that to my Chinese students in class, because it was short enough that it could fill in one whole class time, and I showed it to them without subtitles, and then they had to tell me what it was about. They had to write a paper about what it was about afterwards.
Yeah.
So I thought it was funny that you brought up the movie Carnage. Pretty sure you and I are the only two people who have ever seen that movie.
I think it's an interesting movie.
It is an interesting movie, but it's made by rapist.
Yeah. Well, it's the same sort of thing. It's like, I'll always cite Annie Hall as one of my favorite movies. And I got in a fight with a professor in college because she said that, like, nobody should be watching anything Woody Allen does anymore.
So this specific subject could be a whole separate podcast. I am a staunch defender of Woody Allen because he did not commit that crime.
He was accused of it. Yeah.
He wasn't even... Yeah, I mean, and accused is barely even the word. Like, there was never formal charges filed. There was a complaint that was made against the police. The police investigated, a psychologist investigated, and determined no crime took place. Nothing happened.
Yeah.
That is the facts of the case. But people are so have associated that so closely with him.
It is, well, it's because he did do a weird thing. It was just within the bounds of legality.
Is he a great dad? No. Did he run off with his common law wife's stepdaughter from another marriage? Yes. Is that weird? Definitely. Is he an awesome dude? Doesn't seem to be. But he did not molest his child.
It was legal. Everything he did was within the.
Everything he did was skeevy and weird, but it was legal, and he did not commit that crime. That specific crime that he's been accused of, he did not do. That is a verifiable 100% proof fact. His own children, the other children now, have come out and said, like, years later, that, like, yes, Mia Farrow, like, she brainwashed her children into believing that. She brainwashed her daughter into believing that. And that's shitty that you can be a shitty enough dad and shitty enough to your spouse that she can come up with a crime so heinous that it scars your entire career. Like, that you would put yourself in that situation. Because a parent should always be above board. You should never have to doubt, you know, like, my mom sometimes doesn't get along with my dad. But she would never, ever think that we were not safe around him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And so, like, yes, he's shitty for, like, putting himself in that kind of position. And it's a horrible that there is a person in this world who has to live with the notion in her mind that, like, her father molested her and that her mother planted it. She doesn't believe that. I have no doubt that she believes she was molested, but the facts don't prove that. And that's sad and it's shitty, but he did not do that crime.
He should not be
treated as a goddamn pariah. And if honestly, again, this is contradicting my claim about Roman Polanski, but if you can watch Midnight in Paris and not enjoy yourself, you're an asshole. That movie is amazing.
Yeah, he has a lot of great movies. Hannah and Her Sisters is a great movie.
And his whole last, like, mid-2000s, like, his last 15 years have been terrific. Match Point is a brilliant movie. Mm-hmm. I fucking love Match Point. Scoop is great. The other movie he did with Scarlett Johansson.
Blue Jasmine,
I could take or leave.
Vicky Cristina Barcelona.
Love Vicky Cristina Barcelona. Loved You Will Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger. There's one called Cassandra's Dream with Ewan McGregor and Colin Farrell that's like...
Never saw it.
Yeah, it's like eh at best. And there's another one in there that I'm forgetting as well that's like between those movies. But yeah, I mean, To Rome with Love is a great movie.
Never saw it, but yeah.
Saw that one in theaters. The one with the magician, not great. The last one with Colin Firth or whatever. And then the last one, Cafe Society, is the last one. I haven't seen Cafe Society. Heard that's pretty good.
Yeah, I heard it's like if you like Woody Allen, it's a good. Yeah,
I love Woody Allen. Enemy of Manhattan is great. Purple Rose of Cairo is a phenomenal movie.
Radio Days.
So that dude is a genuine, like, master filmmaker. He's a weird dude, and is he a bad dad? Yeah, but he's not a criminal, and he's not a molester, and he's not a rapist.
Yeah,
all things that Roman.
Well, I yeah, he is, but on the same. Back to sort of what we were originally talking about was like
the moral of that story.
I can separate,
right?
Like Rosemary's Baby as a thing is
sure
a masterful piece of horror filmmaking.
Sure.
The guy that made it is a dick, like. Sure. That's so Cosby.
Sure, same thing.
Yeah, The Cosby Show is a classic sitcom. His stand-up is untouchable.
Yeah.
He is a shitty dude.
Yeah. And whether I like it or not now, that set me up for the life of comedy that I am now on.
You and so many other people. I mean, Judd Apatow tweets like 10 times a day about it still because he's so betrayed. Because it was like...
Absolutely. I still, on my phone, I have like, all my music... Google Play, I have all of, like, his albums, I think. So, I mean...
Can you listen to it and just totally disassociate?
I have not listened to it since all of that shit happened, but I'm sure that I could.
Uh-huh.
I'd laugh, but I could listen to it. You know, to my brother Russell, to whom I slept with, like, that's the whole back half of that album is one 30-minute story. He's the best storyteller ever.
He really... And so. Did it clean...
Did it clean, and it's unbelievable. And then Robin Williams Live on Broadway. Have you ever seen that special?
I have not.
It is. People always talk about the first one, Night of the Met or whatever, which is his one from like the '80s. Live on Broadway is from 2001, and it was his first special in like 10 years or whatever it was, 20 years. And that special is an absolute... It's him at his absolute peak of his powers. Like, he comes out with the whole stool is covered in bottles of water. And by the end of it, all of them are gone. And it's like an hour and a half, hour 45 minutes of just straight... And I could recite that special to you as well. And there's so many classic bits in that special. It's just... It's unbelievable. And I was like, I want to do that. I remember me and my friend Phil, every time I go to his house, every weekend I would go to his house and spend the night on Fridays. And we watch that special every fucking weekend. Like, it is unreal how good that special is.
Yeah. When he died...
I was devastated.
Yeah. I remember his death affecting more people than any celebrity death I can remember.
Aside from until this year, until 2016.
Yes, yes and no. Because I think that, like, when Bowie went, that was a big one for people. Prince was a big one for people. But I think there's something about someone who makes you laugh that gets a little deeper than the music. Like, and he was a fucking fantastic dramatic actor, too. Like, there's... Good Will Hunting will make me cry every time I watch it.
I mean, even Insomnia. He's very Insomnia.
He's so good in that. He's
like a Centennial Man. I saw that in the theaters.
Dead Poets Society.
He, pound for pound, probably the funniest person to ever live. Like, just straight funniest person to ever live. And this is going to sound like weird, but I've thought about this a lot, which is comedy. I almost look at comedy like a literal force that you can tap into. And some people, like, open the door a crack and they let it in. People like Liam Neeson, who can be really funny when he wants to, or Johnny Depp, who can be really funny when he wants to. Some people, like, open it when they want and they shut it when they want. But I think that there's also a darkness there, and the wider that door is open, the more susceptible you are to that dark energy. People like Jim Carrey, who is known to suffer from depression and goes through periods of sadness and things like that. And I think Robin Williams is the ultimate example. Robin Williams, like, ripped the door off the hinges and was just fully exposed. And, like, the tool that comics use to wield that force is the mic stand and the microphone. He even got rid of that. Like, he was just, like, letting it all flow out, but as a result, he was also completely susceptible to that immense darkness. And I think that that played a huge part into who he was, which is why when he was on, he was the funniest person you've ever seen in the world. And when it was not, he was not. I do take comfort in knowing that it seems now, if you listen to, like, interviews with Bobcat Goldthwait, who was his best friend, which I love that Bobcat Goldthwait was Robin Williams' best friend.
Yeah, perfect.
I love that they hang out together.
They made a fantastic movie together.
And if you read, like, interviews with his wife and stuff, it appears to be that, like, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's, and he was struggling with dementia, and he decided, I'm not going to go out like that. I'm going to go out as me, as Robin Williams. And don't be sad for me, like, I've had the greatest life that you can have.
Yep.
So, like, it was, like, he was not so all-consumed with depression and all that horrible shit, that darkness, that he was like, I can't take this anymore. It was the opposite, where he was like, I'm not going to let this take my light away. I'm going to take it away myself when I'm still prescient and I'm still here and I'm still me.
I agree. I remember hearing that same thing and being like, that made it...
feel better.
Yeah. It made it better.
Yeah, I'd rather have Robin Williams go out as Robin Williams than have Robin Williams go out as some, like, crazy hobby.
Basically, like how Muhammad Ali is now.
Yeah.
Like, it's like...
he died too.
Well, yeah, but... Or, like, I remember one time being at Yankee Stadium and they were like, oh, everybody, it's Muhammad Ali. And they had him coming from the middle of center field. And it took so long to get him from center field to the pitcher's mound that the song they were playing played three times. And it was the saddest thing I've ever seen. Yeah. So I 100% respect... I always sort of respect the decision of people that are like, you know, fuck you, universe. Like, I'm doing this my way.
Right.
Like, it's like, no one should kill themselves. But I do, when that's the reason, it makes it a little better. Robin Williams, Norm Macdonald, after tweeted.
That tweet, I was going to bring that tweet storm. Yeah.
Yeah. The I'm glad you know about it.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, of course. The funniest man in the world story.
Yeah, he was at the Tonight Show. You want to?
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, if you guys don't know it, I mean, I'm sure you can look it up on Twitter. You can just Google Norm Macdonald, Robin Williams Twitter story or whatever. That's a lot to Google. But he goes on this whole tangent about, like, it was Norm MacDonald's first time on The Tonight Show, and he was really nervous. And he never says Robin Williams' name. He always says, I think until the very end, he always says, the funniest man in the world. He's like, and I was standing there by myself in the green room, and then all of a sudden, the funniest man in the world came in, and he didn't acknowledge me. He didn't say anything. He just started pretending that he was an Italian tailor and just started, like, playing with my pants and, like, running his hand up my leg and, like, just being all kinds of, like, obnoxious stuff, and just made me laugh my ass off. I mean, he just goes on and on and on about that and about just how, like, he just came in and just totally made him feel at ease, and, like, it was effortless on his part. And there's a YouTube compilation called Robin Williams, World's Greatest Talk Show Guest. And it's like just clips of him on appearances of all these different talk shows, of him just fucking around and just being like, you know, the greatest person that he is. Like, I remember on Late Night Show with Craig Ferguson, which is my favorite talk show in general. I mean, Late Night with Conan is,
I mean, yeah,
is more influential, but like in terms of like what I actually liked to watch, like Craig Ferguson was the best talk show host. And he would play games with his host at the end where he could win like $50 or whatever. He asked him a dumb question. And he was like, Robin, you want to win $50? And he's like, I just got divorced. God, yes. Like, just, and it was just like that, just a little comment. It just killed me. Like, he's, oh, God bless him. And when he was on, on Whose Line Is It Anyway? You know, like.
There's a legendary night at UCB. It was in like 2011, probably. He just dropped in on a Harold night, which is their, like, Tuesday nights at UCB, their Harold teams perform. They do, like, the 30-minute improv form, and he sat in with all of them, and you could just see it on their faces. They're like, love this it. Is the most dream-come-true moment ever, just doing improv for 2 hours with Robin Williams.
It's, like, that's the greatest thing ever, and he was the greatest ever.
I think it's on YouTube.
I'm sure it is, you know, and so is Robin Williams Live on Broadway, which is a brilliant
song. Yeah, I will check that out, because he's a fantastic.
I mean, it just starts, I mean, just the way that it starts, he comes out, and there's, like, and there's all, like, these weird, like, polls, and he says, he's like, welcome to my show, which is on the set of The Fantastic Voyage, and then the second line he says is, this isn't stand-up comedy, this is Shakespeare with a strap on. And like, that's the perfect definition for what stand-up is. Like, good stand-up is Shakespeare with a strap on. Like, it's awesome. And it's great. It's an HBO special.
He's one of those guys, too, where, like, you'd be hard-pressed to find someone with a bad word about him.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, even when he was accused of parallel thinking or stealing people's jokes, he made a point to, when other comedians were on stage, he would leave the room just so there was no doubt that he was not stealing.
Yeah, he was. I didn't even know he was part of the joke thievery scandals.
Yeah, which, I mean, it barely counts. Like, they were like, hey, that joke is kind of similar. And he was like, you're right, I'm sorry. Oh, he's like, I didn't hear your joke, but just to put any doubt, you know, it's not like Carlos Mencia was like a bully about it.
Carlos Mencia is a fucking asshole. One of my favorite YouTube clips ever. Another, I like this guy, also an asshole.
Joe Rogan.
Joe Rogan calling out Carlos Mencia at the store.
And bringing in Ari Shaffir, also an asshole.
Well,
I don't understand because, again, drugs. Like, I'm like, you shit about a 42-year-old Jew talking about drugs.
Yeah. That is super interesting. No, that is really interesting to me, is, like, as someone who will, from time to time, enjoy a drug or two, that wasn't, like, a euphemism, like, I'm a terrible addict. I literally mean, like, every once in a while, that stuff is fun. It's definitely, I agree that talking about it nonstop does not mean you have a personality.
Right. It's just
which,
so boring, ugh.
Or talking about it with other people who have done it, you can kind of have that, like, little fraternity.
Experience,
like,
yeah. Like, one of my favorite things about Obama was, like, Bill Clinton, 20 years, like, not even 20 years before, Bill Clinton had to be like, I smoked marijuana one time, I did not inhale. They cut to Obama, and they're like, Mr. President, you ever done any drugs? And he's like, yeah, which ones you want to know about? He's like, I don't know about the time we did the psilocybin, that was a mistake. Whew, man, I tell you, like,
psilocybin.
You know, that kind of stuff is funny. Yeah, sharing experiences is funny. But, like, the car dealership that I used to work at, there was this college kid who worked there. Like, he was still in college. He was, like, a sophomore or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, douchebag, like, pothead hair, super into fish. And, like, you know, and, like, we're puka shells. And he's like, yeah, bruh. And I'm like, you're from Ohio. You're not from the West Coast. Like, calm down. I'm from the West Coast, and I don't even act like that. Relax. And he was like, yeah, man, I spent the whole weekend in my dorm doing heroin.
Ugh.
Snorting heroin. And I'm like, why? And he's like, because I just want to experience life, man. And I'm like, sitting in your dorm room snorting heroin is not experiencing life.
That's horrible. That's
moving to China and teaching English at a university. That's experience.
Well, no, I 100% agree with you. Yeah. If someone said that to me, I'd be like, yeah. "You're an idiot!" Like, yeah. What the fuck?
Yeah. That's Lewis Black talks about that too, where he's like, "I've done every drug that there is to do because I wanted to experience everything life had to offer, and then I realized that watching the sky have a zipper in it is not experiencing life."
No, it's not. No, it's one of those things where it's like you can maybe. It's kind of like being like if you made roller coasters your whole life. There's no substance there. Yeah. It's like 3 minutes of like, and then you're, what are you going to tell every single person about a roller coaster you went on? They'll be like, great, fucking you went fat. Like, I agree in that sense that there isn't. How do we get on this?
I don't know. The moral of that story is that Robin Williams, RIP, you're the greatest.
Yeah, Robin Williams.
Yeah. And then
I was trying to trace it back. I was like, I know Robin Williams loved cocaine, but like that wasn't.
Yeah, we just that kind of. Because you mentioned one of your favorite YouTube clips is Joe Rogan calling.
Oh right, Joe, because Ari and Ari talks about acid all the time. Yeah, because Ari loves tripping balls. Do you ever watch This Is Not Happening?
I just watched it today. I just watched Rory Scovel's.
Story. Oh, the sharding.
The sharding is great. I've seen Brian Regan's. I've seen both of
Boo Sailboat is one of the best stories I've ever
That's
heard.
He's another great storyteller. Brian Regan, Kyle Kinane's, both of his are great. Dan St. Germain's is great.
I think the guy's name is what the fuck is his name? He's a black guy, Ali Sadiq.
Yeah, Ali Sadiq.
Yeah, he talks about like wanting to stab his prison guard Mitchell.
Yeah, the prison riot one.
Yeah. Mexicans got on boots.
Yeah, that's a great... Mexicans got on boots! I want, like, Tom Segura to do it.
Oh, he has done it before. He tells a story about ODing on GHB.
Oh, that's right! He did the story about ODing on GHB.
And the only reason he survived is because he was fat.
He was fat, that's right. I can't believe I forgot about that. Jesus Christ. And his wife did one, too. Christina Pajitsky.
Love them as a comedy couple.
Bert Kreischer's is phenomenal.
Well, Bert is nothing but stories.
Yeah, he's, like, probably, like...
The Machine is the best story
that anybody
like,
can tell.
Yeah,
that
like, anybody can tell. Yeah. He has the best story.
And he's just such a natural, like, storyteller. Like, for me, like, top five best storytellers of all time, Bill Cosby, and not in particular order, except for Bill Cosby. Bill Cosby, Bert Kreischer, Ron White, Kevin Smith is a phenomenal storyteller.
Unbelievable. I have his book right there.
Nice. And then, did you ever see any of the Evening With specials?
Love them.
Yeah, that's all that is just him telling unbelievable stories.
I've been a Smodcast listener since 2007.
Wow. Jesus Christ. I can't believe that's been around since 2007. Bruce has been around since 2007, too.
Yeah, he had one of the first podcasts, him and Scott Mosier.
Back when people didn't even know what podcasting was.
Yeah.
People still don't know what it is.
Well, I didn't know what it was either, but I had just seen Clerks for the...
Look at us now!
It was 2007. I had just seen Clerks for the first time. My brain is exploding, and I'm just Googling Kevin Smith like
it's crazy.
Crazy
that you didn't see Clerks until 2 years after Clerks 2 came out.
Well, I... Yeah. You gotta remember, I'm only 22, so like...
It makes me sad. So you were 12 in 2007.
13, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, like, that was... My mom was pretty strict about the R-rated movies thing until I was, like... Until it got to the point where it was obvious I could just do it anyway.
Sure.
That she was, like, really... I remember the first R-rated movie, she was like, fine, go see it. It was a Semi-Pro, the Will Ferrell basketball movie.
I think the first... I mean, the first R-rated movie I saw, obviously, was Total Recall. When I was, like, four or whatever. But, yeah, it's funny.
Yeah, but, we're a little off.
Yeah, no, comedy. I was going to say, Lewis Black's The End of the Universe.
Lewis Black. I love Lewis Black.
I love Lewis Black. He was the first comedian that I was, like, truly obsessed with. Like, I saw everything he ever did. I've seen every single one of his half hours. I've seen all of his televised specials. I have all of his albums. The two best Comedy Central half hours that Comedy Central presents, the two best are Dane Cook's and Lewis Black's. Mm. And
oh, my God, live, Dane.
And, The End of the Universe is, like, him at his absolute, like, peak of his abilities. Like, his first album was whatever it was. This is his second album. It was recorded in Atlanta. And, like, for a long time, people would ask me, what are your five favorite albums of all time? And that would be, like, it'd be AC/DC, Oasis, and then, if, like, Lewis Black's The End of the Universe would be in there. It's my favorite comedy album ever, and I listen to it sometimes. Like, I haven't listened to it in a while. I gotta go back and listen to it, but it is so... good. And it totally encapsulates everything about Louis Black. Because, like, now, like, he's super overtly political. Like, that's all of his material is just him on stage ranting about politics, which is fine. It's still funny. But, like, this one is him ranting about politics and cell phones.
Like, life.
Yeah, and, like, the Atlanta subway system. And, like, one of his greatest hits of all time that I still say all the time is... the signs over the road that tell you how far you are from your destination based on traffic. He's like, what purpose do those serve? You know what they do? They take away hope. He's like, because of that, you'd be like, oh, but it's down! Oh, but it's down! No, no, okay, so. And then he's like, you know what? He's like, I think it's a perfect opportunity to open a gun shop because I want to advertise on those signs. As soon as the wait in traffic goes over 45 minutes, it should just say, don't you think it's time to buy a gun for Blue? And he's like, why not have just a big middle finger like that? So
My favorite, that's a fucking amazing bit. My favorite bit of his that I can remember is how one time he was in Texas, I think, and he walked out of a Starbucks that's and across the street.
Universe. That's the end of the universe. See, the end of the universe, the nexus of the universe is Houston, Texas, a Starbucks across the street from a Starbucks. That's how he ends the album.
He just leaves a Starbucks. He's like, is this for people with dementia?
Yeah.
Like, you
my
just...
friends, do my eyes deceive me? I think it's time we had a cup of Joe.
We just had one.
I mean, he starts that album by saying, I told my friends I was going to record a CD, and give an example of how smart my friends are, they all said, what kind of CD?
And
he's the fucking greatest. And his he just did Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee.
I just watched it yesterday.
Oh my god, he's a legend, and I love him. And he's influenced so much of my politics and so much of my comedy.
He's interesting to me because I think it's a very rare thing where someone like it's compelling to listen to someone be angry.
Yeah.
It's off-putting 99% of the time, but he's tapped into that way where it's like, it's not.
Yeah. If there's any aspect of his career that I want to emulate, people tell me that, like, you should be more political on stage, because, like, it's a huge part of my life.
You have a strong knowledge of politics.
Well, yeah, it's my degree, and, like, I care about it a lot, and I think more people should. And that was actually going to be, I tried to find a way, I was like, should I do politics as my number five? But I couldn't find something, like, specific enough that, like, you know, I couldn't just go into politics.
It's like this trade agreement of 1997.
Right. Like. There was nothing like that that I could put it on. But like that would be like my number six, like an honorable mention. And Jason Chatfield tells me all the time that...
Who is Australian.
He tells me all the time that I'm the smartest person he knows who doesn't use it on stage. And Devin says that. He's like Trevor... We have conversations.
That's a great Devin.
They're the most brilliant conversations. And then you go on stage and you talk about your dick.
I did not know you could do a Devin Keyes depression. That is.
You do a pretty good Chatfield impression. Do I do it with him when I'm on stage? Like whenever he brings it up.
I've seen that one, but I've never seen your Devin. That was really good.
I appreciate that. So I don't do it because one, like, no one cares what an open micer ultimately has to say about politics. If I do any jokes about politics, they're for dumb things. Like, I'm not, like, talking about, oh, Trump trying to get rid of that Pan-Pacific partnership. Like, it's, I talk about, like, you know, the fact that Ben Carson, you know, is the Samuel L. Jackson character in Django Unchained. Like, it's...
Which is the, I love that bit. That's
thank
like
you. You're the only one who ever laughs at that. The other one that I do about the other aspect of that joke people love, but that second half never, doesn't go well, but... Like, so I joke about things like that, or like Rex Tillerson looks like a villain in Dukes of Hazzard, like, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I would like to be more political, but like, I don't know how to make my anger funny like Louis Black does. But I would, if there's any aspect of his career that I would like to emulate, it's his ability to transition from joking about signs over the road to talking about politics and then back and forth. I would like to be able to weave in between them. But I haven't figured out how to do that yet, which is why I don't do as much political stuff on stage as I would necessarily like to do.
In terms of learning to do that kind of stuff, too, the way that when you first start comedy, you start... Open mics are fucking hard.
Yeah.
You get 4 minutes. Like, that's not time. That's not time to, like, do anything. So you have to, like, piece it together like, you have to build the individual pieces and just hope they work
later. You have to be disciplined and do those bits over and over and over and over. And I still, as a 29-year-old person who's been doing comedy for a while, I don't have that ability. I get so bored with my jokes. Like, Ashley Gavin, who is the greatest, shout out to Ashley, like,
her, I hope Ashley's listening to this. Yeah, that would
if she is, I mean, she's got a lot of time.
Especially if she's not still. Like, maybe
she's driving to a gig somewhere. but, like, her ability to just, like, hone bit after bit after bit after bit after bit and take and leave notes and it's just unreal. And how many times have we heard Chatfield do the couscous joke, or, you know, Marissa Riley, you know, do her jokes and things like that, which is great. But, like, I'll do a joke, I wrote that day, it'll get half a chuckle, and I'm like, that's fine, throw that on the pile. I don't write it down, I don't document it, I don't do anything. Neil Rubenstein, he obsesses over every single syllable of his jokes, and I'm like, it's fine. Like, I'll just do, like, I'm like, tell the fucking China story, and I'm like, So, like, I lack that discipline. But open mics are fucking hard. And it really annoys me when you hear, like, Dave Attell, or, like, they're like, what advice do you have for a comedian? And then they're like, get on stage 7 times a night, 7 days a week. And it's like, yeah, that was easy for you to do, Dave Attell, when you were living in the East Village in 1983, and you could live there for $100 a month, and open mics were free, and you didn't have to buy any drinks. I said, but now you got to work 60 hours a week just to make split rent with your fucking roommates, and you have to pay $5 and a drink at every single open mic you do, at least the ones that are worth doing.
And there's 1,000 times more competition.
And there's 1,000 times more competition, absolutely. And the difference, like, I've done stand-up in New York, I've done stand-up in L.A., because, like, I'm originally from L.A., and I want to go back there. The talent pool here is so deep, like, every comedian is a killer, and in any profession. Dancers, actors, musicians, whatever. The talent pool in New York is so deep. So if you're not great at it, or you don't get great at it, you get flushed out. Whereas in LA, like, the talent pool itself is shallower, but there's so many more comedians that it's hard to stand out just from the sheer numbers.
Yeah. I wish that people got flushed out of here a little more. Yeah, I mean, I always sounds a little arrogant when I'm starting to be like,
no, but you're good. I mean, you know, I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard me say it on stage, but, like, I hear minority comedians say, I'm thinking about quitting comedy. And I'm like, no, please don't. You know who I never hear say I'm quitting comedy? White dudes.
White dude with the beard and the flannel. Yeah. There's a million of it.
Yeah. That's me included.
Yeah. No, it's me too. It's like, it's so hard to stand out as something when you don't have, like, now. I also hate that it's like a thing now. Like, if you're Mexican, you gotta have your 20 minutes of I'm a Mexican, or, like, if you're gay, it's gotta be all about, like, you know, my butthole looks like it's been.
Gavin, I'm a lesbian, you can stop thinking about it.
It's not bad. You have to now. I just.
And every comedian's gotta have a podcast.
I dislike that's the culture. Podcast has been fun. This is the first...
I think podcasts are great. I think anybody who wants a podcast, as long as it's original and you're offering an original form, like, this is, like, a unique thing. You're like, bring your top 5 things, and, like, you know, like, this is fun.
Oh, I never wanted to be the guy that's like, let's fucking wax poetic about how important we are.
Right. So your dad raped you when you were a child. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that's not my job.
And the worst podcasts are the ones that are, like, radio shows, where they have, like, people who call in. Like, there's nothing worse than a podcast where I'm listening to somebody talk on the phone. Except for Neil Rubenstein's In Traffic with Neil Rubenstein, which is what that podcast is about, and that's a specific thing, and it's great you should all listen to that podcast, too.
Yeah.
I'm just plugging all these...
Yeah, you're just giving shout-outs left and right. I hope at least one of these people listens to hear it.
I have a lot of time alone at my job, so, like, this just helped me kill the time.
Yeah, no, I'm a huge podcast fan. What are your, like, top...
My top, right now, my number one is The Boogie Monster with Kyle Kinane and Dave Stone.
Great.
Phenomenal. I was just listening to the one when I was at the gym. There's this new podcast that I've been listening to that I love. It's called Make Me Smart, and it's hosted by, I don't know if you know the show Marketplace, which is a public radio show about, like, the economy and things like that. And the two anchors, it's them talking about things that are not related to economics, but things they find important. And so people will email them questions, things that they don't know, and then they answer those questions. So, like today's episode is about, like, what's the phrase they used? Economic protesting. So, like, people who...
Like boycotts and stuff?
Deleting Uber, as a way to get them to change their policies and things like that. It's really, it's quite fascinating. They talk about all kinds of stuff.
That sounds awesome. I'll check that out
for sure. It's short. It's like 20, 25 minutes each episode. I love You Made It Weird. With Pete Holmes.
One of my all-time favorites.
Yeah.
You Made It Weirds have changed my life.
Yeah.
Like, listening to certain conversations, Harris Whittle's second one, the one right before he died, mm-hmm. changed my perspective on almost my whole life.
Interesting.
Because you can hear him, you can hear that he's too far gone in that episode. Have you heard it?
No.
The one where he talks very openly about having a heroin problem, and it's the only time in his podcast career that he talks about it.
Interesting.
And it's not Pete Holmes' fault, but it seems like it almost felt like they were normalizing it. And I remember after hearing it, I was like, is that a thing? Like, can people do opiates? And it's like a and then 3 weeks later.
Yeah.
I saw the headline and I was like, this is like,
that's how it always goes.
There's this, it changed the way I think about almost everything, because I loved Harris.
The same thing happened for me with Philip Seymour Hoffman when he died, because I loved Philip Seymour Hoffman, and I posted something about it, because just like a few weeks ago was the 3-year anniversary of his death, and I posted a thing where I was like, he got into drugs and shit when he was 19, and then got out and went to rehab and was clean for 23 years, and then Ethan Hawke retells the story where he was like, they were doing Death of a Salesman together, and Ethan and Philip Seymour Hoffman had told him how he'd never had a drink as a man. He'd only ever had drinking drugs as a kid, and he wanted to have a drink as a man to see if he could handle it. Less than a year later, he was dead from a heroin overdose.
It's a real disease.
It's a real disease, and again, like I was talking earlier about like how logically I don't understand drugs. Like, how in 2017, knowing everything we know about heroin, how would you fucking do heroin? Like, who ever thinks, oh, that's...
Well, you never... I've seen it, because my high school has this ridiculous...
Yeah, see, and I'm ignorant of that, because like, I don't know anybody who's ever been on heroin.
I know a couple of people who have been through the rehab process.
How does one get to that point?
The idea that you would just start shooting heroin, that would be like... I'm trying to think of a good comparison, where you're like, oh, I want to get into extreme sports, and you start with wingsuit flying instead of skateboarding.
Okay.
Like, that's ridiculous. Like, what happens is most people will either fuck around with Oxycontin at, like, a party. You'll take one Oxy. You'll feel great. I mean, have you ever had your wisdom teeth out?
No, actually.
Okay, so if you have your wisdom teeth out, you get Percocet. It feels great. Feels like your insides are a fucking fleece blanket. I took Percocets for 3 days when I had my wisdom teeth out, and the come down from that was so shitty that I can't imagine what a real opiate withdrawal is like.
Interesting.
I was nauseous and didn't want to talk to anybody for a full day after 3 days of one Percocet every 7 hours.
Wow.
So the people that end up on 25 a day Oxy habit, what'll happen is you start taking more and more Oxy, and then your habit's $150 a day, and then all of a sudden somebody's like, hey, you can have the same heroin habit and it'll cost you $8 a day, because heroin's the cheapest drug there is.
Yeah, which is crazy.
And then that's what happens, is you're like, you can't afford this ridiculous pill habit anymore, so you switch to powder heroin, and then you're fucked. Especially because
it all starts with marijuana, kids.
No, it doesn't. Actually, it really does. I always don't like that, like, cause I like... Everybody that does hard drugs started with... It's like all fingers are... Not all thumbs are fingers, that kind of thing.
Right. Well, no. It definitely does not. I mean, there are people who only smoke weed who've never done any other kind of drug. They fucking love weed. You know, Bobby Sheehan was talking about, like, he'd rather be drunk than be high or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. Or the opposite. There's something really interesting about, like... They did a study that showed that, like, the problem with DARE, the program DARE, was that... It was like, do not do cocaine or heroin. You will die.
It's lies. It's straight up lies.
Then when you do cocaine or heroin and you don't die, they're like, oh, this is bullshit.
Yeah, now you're invincible. And they don't tell you real things. Like, the DARE should be like, hey, guys, you know, wait till college to try weed.
Yeah.
Like, don't fucking get all stoned in high school. Like,
I always say, like, if DARE wanted the ultimate example, they should use the captain of my high school football team, who was, like, this chiseled Greek god, like hottest guy in school, super popular, and he's a great dude. He still is. And then but he drank his face off all through high school and all through college. And now he's like this fat, bloated, like bald, with like a big round head where before it was like square. Like he looks awful. And I'm like, don't want to do drugs. This is what happens after 5 years of drinking. Like just
yeah, no. Well, binge drinking, it's that there are like it's bad, but the way that they phrase it is just as bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we have one more. We've got very off track. Conan O'Brien.
Oh, yeah, Conan O'Brien, man. I mean, like, I don't know. Are you young enough to have watched Conan O'Brien? Or old enough to have watched Late Night with Conan? Because he's been on The Tonight Show, or he's been on his show now since 2009.
I remember the huge shakeup.
Yeah.
That was right around when I started getting into Late Night. I wasn't a Conan. I was a Jimmy Kimmel. I loved Jimmy Kimmel. And I like Conan now.
Okay.
But I wasn't... I've watched YouTube clips and stuff, but it wasn't, like, recording.
Yeah, see, Conan... I think Late Night with Conan O'Brien is, for people who are my age, what it was for Conan's age when he was watching Late Night with David Letterman. Like, this super smart guy who did the dumbest things, like, the most silliest things you can do just because he thought it was funny. And I loved that so much. Like, his favorite clip of all time, when he was ending that show, and the very last clip he showed, he said, all you gotta do is show this at my funeral, it tells you everything about me. And I was like, it's gonna be the Long Island old-fashioned baseball sketch. And that's exactly what it was, which is he found there's a group of people in Connecticut, rather, who play old-timey, like, 1800s baseball. And he went and played baseball with them. And he dressed up with the mutton chops and the hat and, like, used their, like, old-timey lingo. And, like, he was, like, heckling the pitcher. Like, the pitcher threw the ball, which is called an apple. And the hurler, and the guy was called the hurler, and the ball was, like, low for a ball. And he was like, if that apple were any lower, I'd have to dig a trench to Hades just to get it out. And then, like, a plane flies over the crowd and he's like, what is that demonry? Like, it's just the silliest, dumbest thing, and it's so completely funny. Or, like, you know, when they went back in time and to, like the late show in the 80s, and it was David Letterman, and he's like, where are you from the future? And he's like, yeah, whatever, nerds, next. Or, like, he found out that his show, it aired at, you know, 12:30 at night in every region except for Houston, where it aired at like 4 in the morning. And so he went to Houston at 4 in the morning, and people recognized him. And he didn't have Andy Richter with him, and the one guy was like, where's your buddy, the fat guy? And he's like, oh, Andy, he's in rehab. And the guy was like, oh, that's a good place for him then. Like, it was just so dumb, and it was so silly, and I loved it so much. And my mom would make me go to bed, and then I would wake up and sneak into her bedroom while she was still downstairs, and I would watch Late Night with Conan, or I would go to my friend Phil's on Friday nights, and we would watch it, you know, on Friday. And it was just the ultimate example of a genius who was allowed to do whatever he wanted. But the absolute best that he ever was during the 2008 writer's strike, when he didn't have his writers, because Conan's, if there's any flaw, he's not a great interviewer. He's a very, like, it's very scripted. Like, he's very, like, Tonight Show, where it's like, oh, I heard you had an incident on flight. Tell us about that. Like, I love Craig Ferguson's show because it was the opposite. He threw out the cards, and he was like, so, what's happening? And then they just bullshitted for 20 minutes, and it was great. That's why I love that. But Conan was, like, very, like, so he's not a great interviewer, but, like, his flaw is that he's funnier than his writers are. So when he had the writer's strike, and it was just him, he did whatever he wanted. When he had his, during the writer's strike, he built a maze between the curtain and the desk. And whenever his guests came out, they had to navigate the curtain to get to his desk. Or, like, he put his desk on a forklift and then would drive it around the studio and park it in different places and then do the show from that place. And then, of course, the ultimate, the famous one, is he got the zip line installed, and he started using it to reenact, like, he saves Abraham Lincoln with the zip line, or he puts on rocket boots and flies into giant bowling pins and shit like that. And it was just, it is the purest expression of childlike joy that an adult man can do on television. and the reason it was so influential to me, and I talked to like other friends of mine about this, which is like the one thing that we don't want to let go of as we get older is our sense of childlike wonder at the world.
Mm-hmm.
And Conan is the ultimate example of that childlike wonder of the world. Like, he goes, now his show is like a travel show where he goes to all these different countries, and he's just like, he goes to the cigar factory in Cuba, and he's like trying to roll the cigar with the lady, and he like makes the worst cigar, and he's like, is this good? And they're like, no, it's not good. Like, he's just like, it's just the best. Or when he did like his live show, you know? And
the Conan can't be on TV tour thing.
Legally prohibited from being funny on television tour. Yeah, he's just the greatest. And that show meant so much to me. I was so sad when it was over. And then, of course, he got treated like shit. And now his new show is the exact same thing. He can do, not his new show, it's been around for 7 years, but he can do whatever the fuck he wants.
They do great stuff on that show. Their segment, and Andy Richter is easily the best sidekick in late night history.
Yeah, and he's exactly what he's supposed to be. And there's one episode where, on his new show, where they're talking to Jonah Hill. And Jonah Hill's talking about when him and Channing Tatum were having a conversation about, like, who's the greatest rapper.
I've seen this.
And they turn to Ice Cube, forgetting that he's Ice Cube. And they're like, Ice, who's your favorite rapper? And he's like, me, motherfucker! And then Conan's like, yeah, that's what we all say. And then Andy does it in the most white way possible. He's like, yeah, when people ask me who's the greatest rapper of all time, I always say, me, motherfucker. Like, and I love that they love each other.
Oh, yeah, you could tell they're,
like, the best of friends. And, like, you know, he would do gags with his announcer on the old late night show. Like, when he hosted SNL, and he took the camera upstairs to his office to show people the late night show. And they go in, and Max Weinberg is having sex with his wife on Conan's desk. Like, just shit like that. It was just, he's just the greatest. And I hope I never lose my sense of childlike wonder that I get from Conan, and I get from Jim Carrey, and people like that.
That's awesome. It's funny, because if I was to be a guest on my own show, my number one thing, hands down, would be The Simpsons. There's a large gap between 1 and 2. I fucking love The Simpsons. I probably watch 4 episodes a day still.
Really? Do you have the Simpsons World?
Fuck yeah.
I love Simpsons
World. Random episode button on Simpsons World changed my life.
I didn't realize when I... Because, like, I was, like... I caught kind of the tail end of The Simpsons. Like the last, like, 3 good seasons, like, 9, 10, 11 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There's
a large debate on to where this show...
Where the show devolves.
I think it's the movie. 2007.
I think it's the movie. I think it's the episode. I think it's the 300th episode, the Spelympics.
Okay, yeah, I remember that
that's
one.
That's my favorite episode. And that's kind of for me, like, after that, like, I don't think I've seen a funny episode since then. But that episode, I can't believe the movie came out in 2007. That's crazy. That's 10 years ago. So I started watching it on Simpsons World. I didn't know how many classic episodes come just from the first 2 seasons. Like, Lisa plays the blues,
Seasons 3 through 8 are perfect. There's not a bad episode in seasons 3 through 8. And Conan wrote a lot of them. Not a lot of them. He was a staff writer on all of them, but he wrote what might be top 5 best episodes.
Did you know
which
that the guy who did write a lot of those is Gwen Stefani's brother?
I did not know that.
Yeah. He was in No Doubt, and then he left No Doubt to write for The Simpsons.
That is so awesome. That guy lives an awesome life. Conan wrote the monorail episode, though, which is one of...
The monorail's a great episode. Yeah, I did not know that, but that's phenomenal.
It's one of the only episodes he solo penned.
Yeah.
And it's the whole thing with Lyle Landley and the song.
That's great. And it's funny, going back slightly, I said Conan was a bad interview. He's not a bad interview, but, like, his show's format for interviewing is not great. But, like, if you ever watch Serious Jibber Jabber, which is his web show that he has, where he interviews one person for, like, an hour and a half. The very first episode he ever did is with Jack White, and he has one episode where it's a Simpsons writers reunion, and it's...
I've seen that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they showed all the old pictures of them, like, in this shitty room in, like, 1991.
If you ever watch his episode of Inside the Actors Studio, he's the only writer ever to be on, and the only, like, TV host to be on Inside the Actors Studio. Even that is great, because, like, even that, he can't help but fuck with James Lipton. Like, have you ever seen it?
At one point,
he asked James Lipton, you know, because he's got this stack of blue cards, and he's like, can I have the cards that you're done with? And then James is like, at the end. And then at one point, James turns to do something, and Conan reaches and takes them. And then James turns back, and look on his face, and Conan's like, ha ha! He's like, look at how he does when they're physically moved from his presence. And like, and him and James Lipton, like, Lipton was on the old Late Night Show for a lot. And it was right before he was moving to LA to take over the Tonight Show. And Lipton was like, he's like, now I'll never do your show because you're on the West Coast. And he was like, you'll do as you're told, James. and the very first episode of the Tonight Show that he did, the whole opening thing where it's him and he's like in his office and he's like, it's a checklist for the Tonight Show. And the last thing is move to LA, and he looks outside and it's New York. And he runs across the country while Cheap Chick's Surrender is playing. And he's, like, swimming through rivers. And then he finally gets to the office and he doesn't have a key to the studio. So he walks off camera and comes back with a bulldozer and just plows through the wall. And then that's how the show starts. He's the greatest.
It's pretty amazing.
I love it.
That
is a sign that we should end.
I think that was as perfect a thing as ever.
For those of you guys who aren't watching, the omnidirectional microphone just tilted on its hinges and smacked against the end.
Yep. So, but thank you for being here. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me, man. I've been looking forward to this. Is it narcissistic that when, like, I'm like, I want to be on this podcast? Like, people, my friends started and I'm like, I want to be in your podcast because I love talking. It's my favorite thing. My dream job is a talk show host.
Uh-huh.
So, thanks for so much for having me. This has been an absolute blast. Yep. This has been my favorite podcast that I've done. Don't tell that to Jacob if you think it's my ex-girlfriend, but I actually fuck her.
No, I really appreciate you being here. Thank you so much. You want to plug anything?
Trevor Selby, Trevin Claw on Twitter, and on the Instagrams. I'm up all the time. I do have some stuff on YouTube, and I'm a pretty hilarious dude. So
you have a show?
I do have a show. I host a show Saturdays in Brooklyn, Comedy at the Kent Ale House in Williamsburg. It's one stop on the L. It barely counts as Brooklyn, people. It's a great time every night. Mr. Passeretti is going to be on it in a few weeks. And we have, you know, great comics every single night, a packed room every night. It's a great, great comedy room. And it looks like I'm going to get my own franchise because the owners of that facility have a sister place in Hell's Kitchen, and they want me to do a show there as well on Fridays. So I might be having back-to-back shows. I'm going to call that show Comedy in Hell. So, yeah, come on out, guys.
Very cool. All right, thanks for being here, man.
Thanks.
All right, bye.